Welcome, Sega fans, to another episode of that show that's just like the Saturn. It's a bit out there. It's the Sega guys. I'm Dan the Mega Driver. With me, James the Sega Holic. How you doing, mate?
I am brilliant, mate. How's yourself?
Very good, mate. Very excited because we are not alone. We have not one but two special guests today. We are joined from the Sega Saturn Shiro group. It's Saturn Dave and Pat. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on the show. How are you both doing?
Saturn Dave.
Good, hanging on there. Are we? Is there going to be video of this, or is this going to be audio?
They do video.
Yeah, it's going to be video.
Yeah, they
but
do.
Okay, got so my ugly I do need to put on clothes then. Okay, sorry, let me go. I'll get some pants on. I'll be right back. No, yeah. But it's good to be on here.
You only have to do the top half though, Pat.
That's what I assumed. I always only do the
naked
top half,
from
so.
The waist down.
Exactly. You know,
I'm not going to get it.
Pat's in Winnie the Pooh mode, sitting there.
Exactly. you know the term rock out with your... Anyways, it's good to be on the show. I'm really happy to be on. I've listened to you guys for quite a bit. I really enjoy your podcast. I think my favorite one so far is the Dreamcast Awards.
That was
JoJo.
Amazing.
Yeah, JoJo, yeah. RIP, but you know, besides that...
JoJo. Well, it's hard to narrow it down, right? You know, that's the tough thing when you
ever do. I mean, you could narrow it down
lists,
pretty well,
you know?
Right here, you know, just like
Do you know? I think that category got the most heat because James was like, "We forgot Power Stone," and then like all the commentary on Radio Sega and everywhere was like, "You forgot this," and now you're giving us grief about JoJo.
Listen, you know, I'm not saying I'm a weeaboo, but I mean.
Weeaboo. Like,
exactly. Yeah,
but he totally is.
Literally. I mean, yeah. Speaking of Power Stone, though, I have something cool, though.
Thank
God, whenever he stood up, there was bloody shorts.
Oh, yeah. He's got the standee, that little, not a standee, but a little countertop thing. He's gotten a crazy offers for that, like over $1,000 or something.
Wow.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously. It's that rare.
That was $1,300, I think. But
like, it's like, you know, just keep it. I mean, it's just going to get rarer.
I look at it this way. I can easily get $1,300, but I can't get that again. That's sort of my mentality, because it's like, yeah, I could get that. But I mean, literally, I'm going to have to hunt that down and just like try to find it again. But yeah, I'm a big Power Stone fan. I think, and the funniest thing, I just traded that for some guy just won a copy of Sakura Wars, So Long My Love, on the PS2. And I was like, okay, I'll trade you a copy of that.
Sure. You know, you could acquire that again.
Yeah. So guys, just in case, I'm pretty sure all of our audience knows who you are, but just in case there's any watching that don't, just do you want to give us a brief little overview of what you guys do? How did the Shiro group, I mean, you guys do podcasts, websites, videos, basically everything Saturn related is out there. So yeah.
I mean, we forgot to announce our OnlyFans too, but I need to get that sorted before we put.
Oh, you got my sub.
That's only for the that's only for the patron insider.
Oops, that leaked out early. All right.
Honestly,
my bad.
Pat and I were just two guys milling around Facebook groups back in like 2016.
Literally, that was it.
We were two of the only. I would say we were probably posting the most. At least personal stuff and you know, maybe doing a video every once in a while, or you know, hot takes or whatever. But the point was, you know, I would get on Facebook with my phone really janky setup and just like beg other people in the group. I think it was at that time it was like Saturn Collectors of America to like, hey, does anybody else have a phone and feel like, you know, putting your face in front of the camera and sharing, like, because I missed out on Saturn community growing up, you know, like I was completely alone in my fandom, except for like my little brother. He kind of trailed along with me, but then he kind of went off with the N64 and whatnot.
He went to the dark side, the PlayStation.
No, my dad went to PlayStation. It's a long story, but I did a podcast, a bonus cast on it or whatever. You can listen to it. But anyway, essentially, I missed out on that. So I kind of was seeking it out around like 2016, because in 2014, 15, I was kind of starting to acquire games again and try to. It was a stupid mission. trying to get Saturn games like in 2014, 15, because they were already like ridiculously gone. The market was already gone even then.
I still think it's quite quaint that we joked about how it was unobtainable to get Panzer Dragoon Saga for $500.
Oh yeah, I actually somebody was asking $400 and I was saying like you're charging too much, you know. And I was kind of got in an argument on Facebook with this guy, and now I feel like I owe him an apology. I'm like, I'm so sorry.
It's like, I'll still pay for $400.
But yeah, so like all I ever wanted was community. And like more people sharing their Saturn stories, because I figured it was like, if we can bring everyone out of the woodwork who is a Saturn fan and come together, then we can kind of feel what PlayStation fans felt back in the day, like what it's like to have camaraderie, what it's like to have community around the love of this console. And Pat actually reached out to me. I don't know. We both love Police Knots. We both love Kojima games and Snatcher. And I don't know. We chatted one night for hours just on Facebook Messenger, and then like he shot me a message later on like, you want to do like a podcast? I was like, I've been waiting for an opportunity, like I've been waiting for somebody to ask me, would you like to do a podcast? Because all I do is talk, and Pat will tell you that like I need to shut up, but I talk a lot and I have a lot of things to say.
I just do a little bit of one of these ones when I need him to
but it's true.
Honestly, I don't think I've ever said to Dave before, but I actually do love the fact that he talks quite a bit, because I mean, I'm not the best talker. I'm a great listener, but I'm not the best like continuous talking, but Dave like covers my ass. And that's what I love about Dave though, is that he can cover me on that, and I can like bounce off him and like sort of react on that, which I appreciate.
Yeah. It's funny too, because Pat will be the first to tell you that he has like, anxiety. Not speech probably. Yeah. I don't know. There's something like, issues with anxiety. Talking and
yeah,
stuff
it's,
like
it's
that.
It's a cerebral palsy thing.
And funny enough, like, I don't know why, but I just suggested out the gate that Pat be the host. Like, I could have been the host, Kay could have been the host, but I was like, why not Pat be the host? He's a funny guy, you know? And so we picked the guy who
worst
has, like, the most anxiety. No, but I think it really helped him. I think back in 2017 to now, like, it really, like, he just went right into the role, and he was so funny on those early casts and would always open with jokes and stuff. And, you know, he has way better comedic timing than me. So long story short, we did the cast for several years. Just, you know, a lot of those episodes were like trying to cram as many good games into a single episode, talk about a bunch of stuff. You know, and it just kind of snowballed from there, and we decided to do a website and, you know, a Discord server and a bunch of other projects. We just love the Saturn so much.
We just love throwing DARP stuff at the dartboard. Like, I think that's what Dave and I vibe is, that we love throwing stuff at the dartboard and like seeing what sticks, mm-hmm. and just like keep trying it, you know, which I appreciate.
And we just love a lot of the people that we've met through this community, through Sega and through the Saturn.
Our heroes too.
So the podcast, if you listen, depending on what year you listen to, it's gone through so many changes. Gone through different cast members. It's gone through a different formula as far, you know, we really kind of scaled it back to like focusing on one or two games so we can really get into the meat of a game, rather than every episode just being a listicle of like, try all these games, you know, because we didn't know what we were doing at first. And I have to say, I'm really glad you guys are back. Because I was so disappointed when you guys had to take a hiatus, you know? And now I'm, like, super impressed at just how, productive you are. Like, you guys are, like, a machine now, and you're pumping out
surprised ourselves.
Oh, my God, but it's... I'm so happy, though. I'm happy for you guys and happy for the community, because now we have more great Sega content, you know?
Yeah, I mean, thank you, but... you know, we love being back, and we love the fact that, you know, we were on your podcast, which was brilliant fun, and now you guys returning the favor and coming in here. But the way that you're just so laser focused on the Saturn is just amazing. Like, me and James are, I think you called us all over the place, because we kind of pick and choose. Or this week we'll do Game Gear, this week we'll do Dreamcast.
Well, you're just, you really give, you're all about Sega. I didn't mean that as a bad thing.
No, I know you
did. Saturn fans.
No, we know
but
that.
I meant it as an insult, though.
My hat's off to you guys, because again, you know, like covering all that stuff, it's a lot. There's just so much good stuff. And being laser focused about the Saturn means that we it's very niche, you know.
It's niche, but yeah. The one comment I ever always get from everybody, well, what do you only focus on Saturn? Aren't you going to run out of material? And yeah, it's like, true. No, literally, I was talking to Dave the other day, and it's like, he saw a game he didn't know existed. Well, he's been with the Saturn for almost 20 years. And
that's true. I still need to look at that. I still need to look at that game. It was like a Koei game, and it was a like a noir mystery game or something.
It was like Eno. It's like that style, like Enemy Zero. It's kind of like Enemy Zero esque.
Yeah.
Tariko or Lunacy?
No. One of my favorite games, actually. Lunacy is like one of my favorite Saturn games. No, it was something in that vein. So something in that vein, but it's a Koei game. And Koei game usually does like grid-based strategy games, which usually turn me off. I'm not really... Although Gotha 2 or what is it? Heir of Zendor is a great... I really like that one, but I don't think it was released in the PAL territories, but you guys should check it out. No, something else. Mystery something. And I've passed it over in lists because it's
It. Mystery Seven Mansions by Koei.
Mystery of Seven Mansions. Something to check out. I needed to put that on my reminder list because we were doing the live show the other day. But anyway, I'm just saying, like, I'm always finding it's funny. Like, I think I know everything about Saturn. And even Peter and I have done like pop quizzes, like with our most deep knowledge. And it's like now I'm still finding out about like Japanese games that I've passed over in a list because they just didn't like, you know, they just didn't like hit me. Yeah, like, I got to try that one.
I mean, there's like over 1,000, isn't there? I mean, you know, that's 1,000 episodes of content right there.
Yeah.
You know, even if you get to the end and you're doing stuff like, you know, Air's Adventure or Tokimeki, one of the Tokimeki
stuff like that. I know. The more games that get translated, the more stuff we have to talk about. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's just amazing. And I guess the point was that there's just so much stuff for the Saturn that you think we'd run out, but there's new project, there's new, you know, translations, there's new peripherals that we found, there's new content, there's cut content that's found, you know, there's documents that have been uploaded to the internet, there's betas, there's so much stuff that it's impossible to like keep a track of everything, and that like just more and more content every single day. Like, I mean, sometimes we get like lulls in the news stream, but like some days we just like explode and we can't even cover it in one episode.
I think
that's the thing as well, though. The thing is quite funny is that for being the console that nobody wanted, you know, back then, all of a sudden to find it being, I mean, it's got the most options for ODEs. You know, you've got all these kind of Bluetooth peripherals, the Bluetooth one that you guys looked at recently as well.
Right.
There's just so much going on. The fan translations, I mean, there was Tom Fun, who is very often in your live chat as well.
Tom.
Good dude. Love Tom Fun. Shout out.
Yeah. Shout out. What about Tom?
Well, he was saying yesterday that he tried to play Snatcher, and he was trying to do it by using, I think, like kind of Google Translate, whether it was a camera or kind of internet and text, and he says he gave up, and he was looking at doing like Police Notes as well. And I says, well, Police Notes has got an English translation. And I was like, you need to get an ODE. And he's like, oh, don't tempt me. And I'm like, but you've got like Police Notes, you've got Bulk Slash, you've got Stellar Assault, you know, you get Sakura Wars, you've got Dragon Force 2, Shining Force 3, Scenarios 2 and 3, all this amazing stuff. And I'm like, to Derek, that does a lot of the kind of the lead on that kind of community stuff. And I'm like, do Sega Gaga. Do Sega Gaga, please.
Actually met up with Derek last week, actually, in New York City. Because I went to
18.
I met up with him and you know Bob from Retro RGB.
I seen the picture on Twitter. Yeah, we go.
Yeah,
in the car with Bob.
Yeah, we hung out. I love those dudes. Like, and there is actually some big stuff in the pipeline for Derek that he reached out to me about that we're gonna be doing some stuff soon. So I'm mega excited for that. I really can't talk about some of the projects, but there's one big one that I think is going to blow the minds of everybody once it's announced. And it's amazing. Like, I can't speak on it, but it's just insane. But
that's awesome.
I love Derek. I literally love Derek.
They're great guys. They really are. And then, I mean, they just love were them. Dudes in our Discord community a few years ago. And Bob started making this amazing site on all the ways that you can connect your consoles and, you know, RGB and just implementation of different. I mean, it's a great website, a great resource for the community. And of course, Derek just started hammering away at Dreamcast translations. Before you know it, we've got like he's done several games under his belt. But yeah, no, I mean it's crazy. The thing is, there's an appeal to the Saturn for me. It's just it's such a mysterious kind of console, really. I mean, it's like I don't want to say that the Genesis or the Mega Drive is like an open book. But it kind of is like I love the Mega Drive. I love the Genesis is right there. And I've got like the tower and I absolutely adore it. And I love the Dreamcast. I mean, I would sleep with my Dreamcast. It's so tiny and cute and it's such a beautiful design. I mean, seriously, the Dreamcast is a beautiful design. Four screws and it's open. And everything is just so tightly packed, and yet it's just an amazing console design. I love the Dreamcast, but there's just something about the Saturn that has so much mystique. And yes, it's a dark horse. Yes, it is incredibly underrated. And we're trying to change that. But that's what just keeps pulling me back in. And it's like, that's why I want to cover Saturn. I'm just like, I have blinders on for Saturn, you know?
Yeah, and there's no
really... Yeah, and there was really no one at the time doing it when we did it. I know, like, I mean, it was just us. I mean, the Junkyard joined a little bit later as well. But, like, for a time, it was really just us talking about it. There's no, like, Dreamcast Junkyard equivalent podcast that we were on that was for Saturn. So there's a lot on the table, that a lot of us really, me, Dave, and Kay, just needed to burst out and tell people existed and why you should play this console. And that's why we love doing it and still love doing it.
What are you saying, Dan?
No, I was saying, just agreeing with you, Dave. I mean, the console still feels, it's my favorite console of all time. It still feels mysterious to me. The way that I describe it is exotic. I think a lot of it is just how we were exposed to it, you know, when it was live. It was just like PlayStation was everywhere, right? Yeah, I mean, the Mega Drive, when that was in its heyday, you know, it was on the TV all the time. The Saturn, as we've said before, and we say in our Saturn News episode, you know, it just kind of appeared in the UK. There was very little fanfare. I just remember I was in loads of magazines at the time, and it was just there in shops. And even in magazines and stuff that I was reading, you didn't really get an awful lot of info. So it was kind of just this mysterious super console in my head that like no one ever talks about. So that's why that just appealed to me more. And I think that stays with me today, that it's just this very strange, exotic, mysterious black box, which is, you know, you guys are still trying to figure it out. I mean, we're trying to discover new things about it all the time.
Plus, and that's great. 28 years ago yesterday, you know, I had a bit of fun reenacting in video the meeting I had with it. That was
Virtual Fighter at your uncle's house.
That's that. And I was like,
James had the coolest uncle. You had the coolest uncle.
Like, but I'm sitting there thinking, I'm going, like, you can tell I had the house to myself for the kind of weekend, right? Because, like, if the wife and kids were home, there's no way I'd have been able to stand in the hall and change t-shirts and film different angles for this reenacting.
That's
this
great.
But I mean, it's like 28 years ago yesterday that we got it, obviously, in the UK and PAL territories. It's just to think that much time has passed and that we're still finding out new stuff about it. It's just, and we're going to go into it as well, the document leak. The bits in that, my god.
Say one more thing before we get into the document.
So
one thing that I think is amazing is that it sounds like Dan and even you, James, got a Saturn before I did. So I admittedly was late 96, if not early 97. The ship was already very much sinking. In fact, I got my Saturn used and it was $80 with a game, right? And the reason it was so cheap is because they couldn't even sell them brand new, much less sell them used. You know what I'm saying? So the guy in the shop was just like, yeah, I mean, I'll give you a Saturn right now for $80 with Daytona USA. And so that was doable for a kid with, you know, just basically working odd jobs and stuff.
They gave you like a shoebox with my brother, like a couple cords.
It was a plastic shopping bag. It was unceremoniously a tangle of cable. You had the controllers. He threw I came home. My first Saturn was just a plastic grocery bag.
At least I got mine in a cake box.
I bought it. My brother and I pulled in on it. But all I mean to say is that it's, you know, we sometimes we say, oh, I was there, you know. I don't want to say that that's overrated. I just want to say that it's like everybody's come to this console differently. You know, some folks were there day one. You had Sega Lord X importing the Japanese version, you know. You had you guys getting it in the shop, deliberately, determinately getting it in the shop brand new. Good on you, Dan, for being determined and not letting them sway you.
It took me out of it.
You had me getting it used while it was still in the market, you know, but it was failing. And so I picked it up used. And then you have folks like
me.
Pat got into it in the early 2000s. Great time to get into it because it was things were kind of cheap back then. Like you could actually pick up Saturn games. And he found out because he loves Virtual On, right? And then Nick, who Pandemonium, I mean, he's now doing some of the absolute best, if not the best, Saturn documentaries and content, right? And he is younger than us, but he came to the console through his love of several different, you know, Sega arcade games and his love of the Dreamcast and stuff. And it's no less valid, you know, like his experience with the console is every bit as real and every bit as tactile and important, you know, and look at the inspiration that the console has had on him and his content. You know, he absolutely bleeds Sega blue and loves the console as much as we do. So it's like, I don't mean to gatekeep when I say I was there. I just think it's an interesting perspective, us being able to say that we were there, but everybody's come to the console differently. I think Dan Thrax, who writes a lot of articles for Shiro, only got picked up the console a few years ago, and he absolutely loves the darn thing and loves digging into all the history and finding out about it. So that's an amazing thing about it, I think.
And the great thing about that sort of that people getting new into it is that it's a different perspective of it. It's like a retrospect and a fresh eye where it's like you get like, you know, the best, like you get like the clearest, most, you know, unbiased perspective.
True.
And like they give Brulios descriptions of the games. It's like, yeah, I mean, I don't have nostalgia for this game. This game is crap. Like Mr. Burns, right. A lot of people, see a lot of people praise it and love it. And it's like, I'll tell you straight up, it's crap. Straight up crap game.
It's a mixed bag, and it's got.
Oh, I'll tell you what kind of bag it is, Dave. It's a mixed bag of something, all right.
That's the thing.
Hairy ball sack.
It's like, how do you even continue your train of thought after that? By Christ, you know, it's like, you know.
Well, a lot of games, yeah, they have charm. It has charm,
exactly, and I think that charm as well. It's, I think people who can come to it later on. And if they haven't got that kind of, we say bias, but it's, they're detached from it. We've still got a lot of like
those tinted glass,
like Virtua Fighter 1. Right, I can hear no wrong about that because I just that game's just ingrained in there because of how I was exposed to it. But then you've got people who come to it today and they would go, oh, polygons glitch, it's 30 FPS, the timing's a bit out in the moves, and it's like, you need to get what it was like.
But it's a lot better. It's actually a lot better than what credit people give it, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because back in the day, of course, it did get crucified a little bit because of that, you know? It was like, because we were comparing everything directly with the PlayStation, right? Oh, Toshinden, you know, look at Toshinden, or look at, you know? But I know, right? Toshinden sucks. Like, I love
Toshinden. I just want to jump in very quickly, Dave, and say, somebody put a tweet out, and it was... PlayStation, the lie of organic growth, right? And it was a variety of clips that they're taking and like from like G4 and IGN and stuff like that. And one of them was Bernie Stoller, right? And he's like, you know, like one of the things I was tasked to do was to bring, you know, third parties on. And he says, when you see the sexiness of Toshinden is not sexy. It's like, it's rubbish.
Where are they going with that?
I'm like,
I mean, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, obviously he couldn't say, oh yeah, Toshinden's absolute dog crap. Don't play it. Yeah, like, I mean, he's like, oh yeah, it's super sexy, yeah.
Pat, we needed you in retail stores in the 90s, mate. I mean, can you imagine somebody comes in for a PlayStation? Don't play that, man. That's just hairy ball sack.
Yeah. Oh, it's like that shit. Get that on my face. Get that shit on
Pat,
my face.
Pat,
I'll give
been,
you the good stuff.
Pat would have been great writing for OSSM. Because, you know, that British humor, they love to do stuff like they'd have Dead or Alive and it would be like only the breast, you know? Like, or absolutely the breast, you know?
Oh, like, God, no, oh, I'm not God. Doing that. I'm not getting canceled that way. No,
they always love they love their sexual puns.
Oh, UK and magazines were brutal for that.
Oh, like, I know.
The captions were hilarious.
They were hilarious. A Taste of Honey.
Tasting you know more what I'm talking about. Than wine.
I mean, I stared at that centerfold. I'm like, here I am staring at a totally not real 3D render. And yeah.
Waves like that on the wall.
Can't stop looking.
But even so, Rich Ledbetter, he wasn't the first to a risque comment, was he, in official Sega Saturn magazine? I remember a few captions. I think there's one with a picture of him with one of the show floor. I can't remember who it was, but it was like, oh, my darling, we could be in Rio in the morning underneath.
Yeah.
a bit creepy there, Rich. Now he's like DF yeah. and all professional. Just find that hilarious. Yeah.
I love it.
No, I mean, it's just hilarious, but yeah, just some of these magazines have like some, I don't know. I grew up on, like, I think my biggest influence is probably a lot of the tech TV stuff back in the day in G4, like, you know, X-Play. I think that's why Dave and I get our same sort of like game here. And our inspirations is that sort of stuff is like, you know, the X-Play, the funny skits, the funny jokes, you know, Screensaver. Did you watch a lot of Screensavers? I don't know if you.
Sure. Me or them? Yeah. You. Yeah, no, I watched Screensavers. I watched,
yeah,
and before that, I watched like the Computer Chronicles. I watched all that stuff. I'm a nerd.
I was jealous though. You had all the cool stuff, like, and all the CBS stuff, or the PBS stuff and all that stuff. It's like New York didn't get much.
Oh really? Okay. Well, I'm jealous of them. They got magazines like Sega Magazine and OSSM. We didn't get that, and I had to import it for like $10 an issue at Barnes & Noble.
Now we know how our fans feel getting the stuff in the UK.
My God. But I mean, like, I was so jealous. I'm still jealous. Like, we got Dreamcast magazine. We got our own. Yeah. But I mean, and we did get Next Generation, which was a great mag. But I mean, I was always, the UK has such a robust, like, magazine scene. Like, you guys know how to do magazines. We just don't.
Every month you would walk into like WH Smith, which is still going today, you know, the stalwart of the train station. You know, every train station in the UK has got WH Smith, but that was like, you would just go in, and like, in the 90s, it was just like a whole wall, and obviously not just the Sega stuff, but like Nintendo stuff and Sony stuff, Amiga stuff. You'd like three or four
Amiga
magazines, Amiga Format, ST, Amiga, Amiga Power.
Yeah, like, I would kill a man to get the PC scene you guys got in the day. BBC Micros, ZX Spectrums, Amigas. Seriously. Oh my God!
Acorn.
Those BBC discs, the big 5.5-inch floppies. Many of them were used as frisbees in secondary school back in the day.
Yeah.
You caught somebody in the eye with one of those bad boys, that was that. You were getting sent to timeout for the rest of the class.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite, I don't know if maybe you heard it before, that there's a song, it's called Hey Hey 16K, and like, it was, I don't know if you guys ever heard that one, it's like, hey hey 16K, what does that get you today? And I loved it, because it's like, man, all this cool stuff, it's like, oh my God. Like, I mean, while we had like cool stuff, like, you know, we had the IBM, you know, the Commodore 64, we had the trash 80s, you know, stuff like that. I mean, you guys got like, I don't know, maybe it's
They had a lot more. Well, Japan had a huge, like, proprietary.
Oh man, Japan.
Scene, right?
Sorry, British. Yeah. Sorry, Brits. I trade for Japan. I'm sorry. RIP.
But we had the MSX too, actually.
Yeah, they did. Damn. Yeah, they had the MSX.
Never mind.
As well.
Okay, I'm back to Brit.
You know, like, as far as the West goes, that's the thing. Is it's kind of the same thing with this. I know you. So you guys argue that it was pretty much equal, as far as like how Saturn did in the UK. And in America, but I still feel like you guys have a little bit of the upper hand, since you actually had a dedicated mag. You know, it would say on the front, like, if the disc is missing, ask your news agent. I'm like, what's a news agent? I don't even know what that is.
These British terminologies, damn you.
Dave's on Google, but, like, what's a news agent?
No, we didn't have any news agents in Reno, Nevada. We had, the best I could do was like walk several miles to Barnes and Noble. And
exactly.
Look at
you got
their magazine rack.
Yeah. You got the poor Barnes & Noble employee up there. I don't know what you're talking about.
With Sega Saturn magazine as well, though, I mean, like Dave, you had mentioned about that kind of fostering that kind of community aspect. And like, Rich Ledbetter, although he's Mr. Digital Foundry to like a whole generation of people, like, he was our leader. Like, he was like the voice. He was the guy that kept on telling you the Saturn's fine. powering on with it. You don't need a PlayStation. Right. He's probably playing a PlayStation whenever he goes home as well, but it's like he just kind of helped really reinforce that you'd made the right choice and that, you know, the Saturn's here to stay and stuff. So we all, that's why, like, I'd love to get him on here, but he's massively busy. I've reached out to, like, Eurogamer and tried to kind of get, I know we've had, like, Tom and Al and like, Peter Moore on, but it sounds really daft, but, like, Richard Ledbetter's, like, the dream guest for us because he just was, like, he was our leader in the 90s. You know what I mean?
I even told John, I was like, I need to talk to your boss. Like, yeah, well, good luck. He's really busy. And you know, when you reach that age, you kind of like don't really need to talk to anybody anymore. You're just like, I want to, you know, enjoy my life outside of work, you know? So I get that. But yeah, no, I was like, I really need to talk to your boss. But we are going to have John on at some point. He owes me a favor.
Yeah, I think we're getting both John and Audie on too eventually.
Whenever I want to cash in on that.
John has told me about 4 or 5 times in DM that he's going to come on here, and then we get to arranging it, and then he's seen the message, and then we never really get anything back. So he's like insanely busy as well.
He's insanely busy too, between
DF and, you know, the DF Retro as well, man. It's like, I don't know how that guy's got enough hours in the day, man. Honestly, it's like
no kids.
He does.
That's right. Yeah, no, he's got a son as right. Well,
so
it's Audi I was thinking about, but no, he's just burning the candle at both ends. I don't know, you know.
So us here, like
that's what we do.
7
right?
a.m. 11.
Yeah, exactly. So but what were we talking about in this?
Fuck agenda for this, right? And we'll just talk.
Well, we were talking about, you know, how there's always, you know, Saturn news coming through, and let's move on to the document leak. I mean, we've hit the mother load now, or at least,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You guys posted I think it was Danthrax posted the article on the Shiro site about, you know,
everyone's posting it. We have Danthrax, Dave did one, and Panda did one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was I think it was it Danthrax that did how the document was leaked or uploaded.
Yes, it was so, Golden Dreamcast. Yeah,
and he paid what, between 400 and 500,
$450 probably. Yeah, like $450 a year ago. Sat on it for a while. Well, didn't sit on it on purpose, but he was trying to work with Force of Illusion to get it uploaded. But it was right at the time where they were kind of dissolving. Yeah. So then he just was like, "To hell with it! I'm just going to buy a scanner and upload it, you know, myself." And so I don't know how good his scanner was, but he did the best he could. Again, it's like copies of copies, you know, it's like he's scanning already Xeroxed copies, you know, so that's in.
But hold on, this wasn't like a file that he got of scans. This was actual original documents that he's then had to scan.
Right. It was a folder. It was a binder. It's a blue binder that says, you know, Sega fiscal year 1997 brand review. And in there are several manila folders with tabs for different like sections, like emails and floor map and branding and promotion and stuff like that.
So essentially this document audit. This stuff would be passed out to like employees during a company board meeting or like a shareholder meeting. Yeah, he's got it right there.
And basically
just, you know, handed to employees. So this isn't like this is just like a copy of a paper, and we're copying that copy. So I mean, it's not a lot, it's still really great we got that, you know.
Oh, gotcha.
Based on, I'm kind of still trying to figure out whose computer this came from. Like, if it was Diane Fournier's, was it Fournasier? I don't know. Fournasier, yeah. That's what I was thinking, like, based on the emails, but I could be wrong. I don't know. I don't think this was, like, directly from Tom's.
I loved the email from Tom, though, kind of early on, where he's talking about, you know, I just wish we could get, you know, media and analysts and gamers to see the success of Saturn in Japan. And I think that last line in that email, that really resonated, because that's what we felt back then. Because as I said before, like, before PlayStation hit, like, there was tangible excitement whenever, like, Saturn got mentioned. I remember in school, as I said, when I was on the Shiro pod as well, it was like I had to, like, steal the instruction manual from my uncle's house to prove, like,
That
it's there.
People didn't believe you. Yeah.
No, people are like, you don't have a 400 quid console. It's like, no, but this is the instruction manual.
Yeah.
And it was like tangible excitement, and then obviously PlayStation comes along and just kind of took over the hype. But that last line was so telling, because you could see that even as years have gone on and we've come to realize, the Saturn was a success in Japan, it was going toe-to-toe with PlayStation in terms of sales, and then Final Fantasy VII hit and changed everything. But to actually see that Tom himself was getting frustrated that nobody was kind of giving the Saturn its due or paying attention to what was going on in Japan that would signal that, no, this machine can be a success. And, you know, obviously, I think the reasons you can see why he just bailed like months after.
He was more than frustrated, I think. I think that he was cornered. Like, honestly, at that point, they were absolutely effed. Like, they were absolutely screwed. There was no coming back. No. What we learned from this document is just how screwed Sega was. Moreover,
it's kind of sad
how demoralized how demoralized his entire team was. That he was sending an email like that, because I think what he was trying to, that was like a pep talk, you know, and it was like trying to get the troops kind of get morale up and be like, we're going to pull through. But I think that he knew that that wasn't true. I mean, how could you with warehouses full of stock like that? Like, how could you, when you're considering scrap value on those systems and then turning them into, it's just, oh my God, it was so bad. Like, and even, I read this, someone else posted an Ars Technica article about working at Babbage's back in 94 to 97. And this just hit, great article. You should definitely read it. He talks about how he was there for three launches, Saturn, PlayStation, and Nintendo 64. I'll send you guys a link afterwards. But he talked about how, like, essentially just working at Babbage's, which is like your sex or whatever. I don't know. Basically,
sex shops that you guys have.
I refuse to call it sex. I'm sorry.
Basically, that when the Saturn early launch hit, they sold out all of the pre-orders, and then everything else just sat in the back room, and they didn't sell it. It didn't sell. And as far as the 32X, it was dead on arrival. They said it literally just sat on the shelf for months and months and months, and they ended up returning it to Sega because they couldn't sell it. Not even at a discount. Nobody wanted it. No one wanted to even buy into the ecosystem for cheap because they knew it wasn't going to be supported, you know? So it was just like dead on arrival. And it was being talked about in the same breath as, you know, consoles like 3DO and Jaguar, which were all at that time seen as dead as well, you know? So it was so terrible, you know?
It was the saddest, really. But I mean, you can't really. The thing is that you see the numbers. PlayStation just had so much momentum that out the gate, it was selling double what the Saturn was making.
It was more than ridiculous.
Double. It's 7-1 at some point, isn't it?
It's
ridiculous.
Panda actually DM'd me at like 2:00 this morning. I was trying to get to sleep to come on here at 7, and he sent me the it's like a kind of rollout map. So it's like all dated like July 7th, 14th, 17th, 22nd, and it's like purple dots on the states where Saturn became available, you know. And it's like, although Tom stood on stage at E3 and said, you know, it's out there, that's what I said to Panda last night on the DM. I said, well, it really wasn't out there, was it? And he's like, no, not at all. But
yeah,
if you look at, obviously, the idea was get out early, get a head start. And then you look at the sales numbers for May through to August for Saturn, and then September 95, PlayStation comes along in 1 month and just fucking obliterates.
130 or something, was it?
Yeah, 130,000. 137,128.
Pretty much as much as it was selling through its lifetime. And the thing that's
almost 140. Wow.
Yeah. And the thing that sucks, though, is that like I was doing research because I don't know if people know that I actually had at one point I had a Saturn kiosk, and I was working on a video for that. And I'm doing research, it seems like when they came out with it, they had to make makeshift kiosks where they just, like, you know, threw a CRT, put it in there, and like put the system in there. And it's like, here's a little kiosk for it, kiosk. And really, they didn't really get an official Saturn kiosk until like months and months later.
Jeez.
And at that point, the worst part is that these kiosks were dual purpose. So they're for Genesis and Saturn. So they're shooting themselves in the foot even more because they're trying to, you know, and like even looking at the document, the stuff that Dave showed, there is still 96 advertising for Genesis no Genesis, Game Gear, and Nomad stuff at E3 in 96. And it's like, yeah, what are you doing, guys?
They spent like 30 grand. They spent like 30 grand on the Nomad booth, but they weren't advertising Nomad at all. Like, they weren't spending any ad dollars on Nomad, and they were hardly spending anything on Game Gear. It was like mostly print ads at that time. Mm-hmm. But that you could see the big circular booth. I mean, we went over the show floor map.
Yeah,
it's just crazy. But you know, it the other crazy thing that I was just thinking was that I just lost my train of thought.
It happens to me all the time, mate. Trust me.
I mean, honestly, even from my own perspective, like, I walked into, I just didn't hear about the Saturn. Like, months went by. I was just a Super NES fan, you know, playing my Star Fox, hoping for a day that I could play Daytona on a console. And I walked into Electronics Boutique, and there was a PlayStation there. And it was like, oh my God, the future is here. Like, here's this console. And it was playing like Jet Moto. And I mean, the physics was pretty great. I mean, the game is aged, but seeing that, it was amazing.
I mean, something you can only get through the arcades. It's like, oh, I get arcade graphics at home. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I have to pay like a dollar to play this damn game.
Yeah.
Now that would have been a demo. That would have been like an early demo. And I think at that point, Ridge Racer was out. They had a couple of like launch games, but then they had like this demo disc, and I was like playing Jet Mode in there. I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. I was really disappointed to hear that it didn't play Daytona, and that the console that supposedly did play Daytona was crap, is what the store clerk told me. He's like,
of course they did.
Yeah. It's terrible. It's not, you know, he's like, if you love the arcade version, well, this is nothing like it. So just forget about it. And
I mean,
so
he wasn't far off, to be honest.
I was told not to buy a Saturn. You were told that the Saturn was crap. Then they go, well, we've got to return these Saturns because they're not selling. Wonder why they're not selling.
Listen, right. I just want to, so I'm going to put this in perspective. So I grew up in the sort of New Jersey, New York area, you know, the biggest probably market you'd want for like the Saturn. So like, I got the TV stations. I used to equivalent to, I'm trying to think who in the UK, it's like Sky or whatever. Like, basically it's like, all the marketing would be in the new. I mean, even PC Engine, TurboGrafx-16 got a big market in New York City and that area, the New York, New Jersey area, because pretty much New Jersey and New York are like side by side pretty much. And so I'm gonna put this hand to God. My first video game console was the Sega Pico. My second was the Sega Game Gear. And the thing is, I knew both of those consoles and I had them and played them. My parents and myself never heard of the Saturn back in the day. It was straight to Dreamcast.
Yeah, according to this document, the Pico didn't do that bad, right? Like, at least initially. Like, the Pico, I mean, towards the end there, of course, but the Pico actually sold, you know?
Yeah, and it's
just until 2005, I think.
Right,
it outlived the Dreamcast.
Past one of the guys that bought it.
Exactly. And it just surprises me that, you know, I could get these obscure consoles and I lived in a giant market, you know, New York City,
yeah,
the biggest market for this console in Jersey, never heard of the damn console. And like, that is probably the biggest death thing. I heard of the Dreamcast. Everyone heard of the Dreamcast.
Right.
No Saturn.
Oh, that was everywhere.
I remember what I was going to say. It had to do with the kiosk. That there's a page that talks about activated or active Saturns where it's talking about like basically store demos. And Circuit City had a ton of Saturn kiosks, apparently. They had like somewhere around like 350 or 380. But everywhere else was like, you know, next to zero. Walmart was literally zero. They didn't have any demo units. There were, of course, tons of places that had like 800 PlayStation demo kiosks, you know, so crazy numbers for PlayStation, but very few. I guess Circuit City was one of the places that got behind the Saturn, according to this document, but I wouldn't work at Circuit City until like the Dreamcast era, so I never saw Circuit City,
by the way.
Yeah, I know, right?
You're talking about kiosks, though. I mean, that's actually something quite interesting. Dan, did you ever see an actual official Saturn kiosk in any store? Because I sure as hell didn't.
Yes. I think I've told this story before, but yeah. So I used to go shopping in, you know, this mall with my mum, and I was 13 at the time. So she'd go off and do her thing. She'd go, you can go off. And obviously I'll go to all the game stores. And I walked into the Sony shop, and they had this huge, And I think this showed the disproportion. They had this huge, I think it must have been like a 50-inch screen, which at the time was absolutely massive, playing Destruction Derby. So I went in there. There was a queue of people, so I queued up to have a go. Played it for a bit. I remember I was thinking, this is great, but the controller is complete ass.
Yeah.
So I can't do anything with this horrible controller.
Yeah.
And then I walked across. Across from that was an Argos, which is like
Argos store.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And they actually had a Sega Saturn kiosk. And it was literally just the small, narrow, you know, just a standard kit. And that's the only one I ever saw. I actually played Sega Rally on there for the first time.
That's right.
I played Sega Rally, and I thought, this controller is beautiful. I'm definitely getting one of these Saturns, but I'm not getting this crappy Rally game. I can't control it.
I just want to point out
my God, what?
Yeah, I mean, Sega Rally.
Were we friends?
Sega Rally was one of the first games I got on my Saturn in my bundle.
Yeah,
I remember. I just kind of put it to the side.
Directly in the bin.
Yeah, so I was I'll play that later. I played and loved Daytona, and then I thought, I'll see if I can work this out. And then it didn't take me too long to actually fall in love with it after that. But yeah, my first impression was Sega Rally at the kiosk, because this handle's weird. I don't like it.
That's crazy. I'm the opposite. Like, my first impression of Daytona was a little rough, and then I eased into it. I was like, okay. Like, I get it and I love it.
I see what's going on.
Like, Sega Rally was instant love at first sight. Like, it was love at first control. I was just like, are you kidding me? This car feels as real as, like, I'm into cars. I love driving. You know, I love driving a stick. And just playing Sega Rally, again, I don't know how. I think James talked about it when you talking about, like, what it is.
I'll talk about Sega Rally all day,
mate. I mean, you talked about how it feels like force feedback without there being any kind of force feedback, right? What you see on the screen and how it relates to your inputs, and you feel that kind of control, the same kind of control that you would feel behind the wheel, you know? And it's just insane. Like, I don't know. Yeah, that was love at first sight for me, that game, you know?
I mean, the thing with Sega Rally, sorry, a wee tangent, right? But it harks back to that whole brilliant kind of Saturn community, because on Hidden Palace, one of the big bugbears of mine, right, is on the bootleg sampler, and Dan's smiling because he knows where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Like, the Celica model is so close to the arcade one. And then for whatever reason, and I hope that Panda covers this in his documentary somehow. Mm-hmm. But
oh, he will.
They changed the damn...
That's the one coming next.
They changed the damn model, and it doesn't look quite as good. And I used to play the bootleg sampler just to see that old proper Celica. And then on Hidden Palace, they put up the full build of that October 95, which is the full game, doesn't have the attract mode kind of sequence. And
right.
The menu's a bit kind of janky, and you can't change the sound volume, if I remember. The BGM volume is stuck on 6. You can't turn it all the way up, so you can't really hear that great music. But you get to play the full game with that gorgeous Celica model, and the colour palette's a wee bit different as well. Like, the muds are slightly kind of lighter brown, and the greens are a bit denser, so they've tweaked a few things. But I'll always play that Hidden Palace build, because it's got that Celica model. It just looks even closer to the arcade.
Speaking of
than
builds, though,
was.
You guys got a better build than we did. We got the crappiest build.
you're that mountain missing.
I mean, but I guess it's indicative of just how poorly we were doing. Like, we need it now. We need it for Christmas.
Well, you did get. The equivalent of Plus and Netlink edition, which added the analog support. We didn't get that. Yeah. We got our stock release. I think the most upgrade we got to Sega Rally was a plastic case.
You're talking about later on with the Netlink version, right?
Yeah.
So that's
did
if you're gonna play.
Did you guys even get Netlink support in the UK for the Saturn?
No. Finland did, believe it or not. Like the Finnish, they got their own Sega Netlink with Sega City or whatever. Their own proprietary connection service. But
I used to be fair. I mean, it probably was hard to get those 1700s wires pushing data for the internet.
Yeah,
you're talking about the UK like infrastructure.
UK,
or what?
Yeah, maybe the wiring and stuff. It's like I mean, it's the same thing in New York City. That the infrastructure there is just so archaic and ancient.
I never even thought about that, but I don't know how that has any bearing on it. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
Could have been an issue.
Of course, you guys can play NetLink now.
We can now.
you should, definitely.
It shows, I was going to say, it shows how desperate Sega were just to get that title up. I mean, we had to wait until, what is it, January or even maybe even February for Sega Rally over here in 1996.
Yeah, January.
See, these you guys had it for Christmas. But I think one thing that I was going to, you know, a good way to talk about this document without going overboard was to say, you know, one thing that was your, you know, really stood out. And I think that ties into what I was going to say is just how desperate Sega were to get things out there. Because the 16-bit market, I think no one knew how much it was losing momentum at the time. And I think when you put it in, when you see it in that context, you can kind of understand why we had things like the 32X and the Saturn, because Sega were just desperate to get something out to regain some sort of market share in 1994, because it seemed like they had a spike post Sonic 2, and then it just kind of flattened out.
Speaking of Sonic 2, they had like how many? In the almost 300,000 copies just unsold, you know, that's crazy. That's a lot of plastic, a lot of PCBs. You know, the funny thing is, there's a lot of talking heads, there's a lot of people on over the years, blogs or YouTube or whatever, who have come with the opinion that, oh, you know, if they could have extended the Genesis longer, or they could have like really, you know, pushed that, you know, done more advertising for Genesis. Now that we look at the numbers and see that they actually had a ton of stock and weren't selling, oh my God, like that would have been just even worse. You know, like if anything, they just shouldn't have made the 32X from the get go. You know,
literally
like
just push every one of them as a Sega CD.
Every 32X, and that's what makes that scrap of that worse, is like you're literally getting value to scrap what could have been. Like, you look at the rollout and how it was staged, you know, state by state over the kind of every 4 or 5 days. Like, if you hadn't made the damn 32X, they're all Saturns.
In the beginning.
You know?
Yeah.
It comes back to, I think, James, you said it on when you was on the Shiro podcast recently. And I think this is what I said to you. When you look at Sega's precarious position in 1994, they needed to get a new hardware out there, but obviously they didn't want to let go of Genesis because it was still kind of new, or it's newer than in Japan. But I think when you see the Genesis, you know, fading away in 93, 94, if the 32X didn't get made, I know everyone always talks about, right, the Saturn launched too early, but I think if 32X doesn't get made, bring the Saturn out Christmas 1994 worldwide. I mean, we had a pretty big rollout of the 32X in the West. You know, we were able to manufacture those. You move those 32X. Can you imagine the Sega Saturn launching in 1994 with Virtua Fighter, Star Wars Arcade, an internally developed version of Virtua Racing, internally developed version of Doom that doesn't run like complete arse. And a 9-month head start on what the PlayStation would be doing. You know. Perhaps,
I mean,
it's easy to look back with hindsight, but
I mean, I definitely think that they should have made the 32X, and they should have stuck to the September launch. They should have given developers plenty of time to just have a massive launch lineup that was strong, give them more time to work on those games so they weren't half-baked as well, you know. Definitely take the properties that you're talking, the IPs from that would have been 32X games, bigger launch lineup, right? Like just kind of what they did with Dreamcast, like have a ton of great games, you know, at launch, just really hit the ground running and, you know, spend those ad dollars, not on ridiculous waste, you know, Super Bowl, weird high concept commercials that are going to play once. And you know, that's what I mean by Super Bowl. It's like, it plays once and then that's it, you know? No, like spend that money wisely on hardware to put out there for people to play. Because if the games are good and people can play them for free and try them out, then it's like it'll sell themselves, kind of, you know? And they didn't do that. They again, I've heard that, you know, it's like mismanagement on Sega of America's part. But again, Tom was forced to do that by Sega of Japan, you know? It was a bad call. You know, they thought that it would pay off. It didn't. It ended up backfiring, you know?
Like, in my opinion, I just think they just should have stuck with the Sega CD, because Sega CD was fine. Like, I mean, it wasn't, like, exploding.
I mean, it was failing hard by this document, like, by 96. Well, okay, so that's by 96.
I'm just saying, like,
94.
Okay. Yeah, when it first, like, instead of doing 32X, put all that effort into the Sega CD, lower the price point, push
and
awesome
SVP games.
Yeah,
yeah, like extend the Genesis with like Vector Man 2 and Sonic 3 Blast and
yeah, and it's
SVP
great music,
games,
like,
you know?
like and it's like, yeah, have the music and make like that, because that was the big thing, the sound of the chip, like put that effort into that Sega CD, because that's what it had over the Super Nintendo, was the Sega CD stuff. So do that, push all that technology, make some great games for it, and extend the life on that. Like maybe, or some RPGs, put some more from Japan on there, or like even make more, and then just release the Saturn in 94 or 95 when it's all ready. And
I mean,
is
there anything in that document about how much they spent to advertise at King of the Ring? Because if you ever noticed, whenever Austin, don't know if you watch WWF or WWE, but when Stone Cold Steve Austin is doing his infamous Austin 316 says I just whipped your ass, the blimp above the crowd has got Sega Saturn on it.
Oh, is it really?
So huh. They're paying for big blimps at WWF pay-per-views.
You it's know what, like, there was something about, there was a, and I don't have it, the whole thing printed out, but there was something about like partnerships with sporting events and stuff like that.
That
easily could have been it. You know, they were, they wanted to push more sports partnerships like they had done in the Genesis era, you know? So yeah, that's crazy.
Honestly, what they should have done is, they should have got, when the Undertaker and Mick Foley did that cage match, just, once he threw, chokeslammed him through the cage, just dropped a Saturn on him. That would have sold gangbusters.
You get Jerry Lawler. That's it. He's dead.
Yeah, exactly. Just throw him off, then throw a Saturn on top of him. Perfect advertisement, and it will never be forgotten. It's like, remember that one time the Undertaker killed Mick Foley by dropping a Saturn on him?
That was 98, though, wasn't it? I mean, that would have been way too late.
Could have been a comeback. Could have been a comeback.
The thing is, if you dropped a Saturn on him from that height, you know the Saturn would still work. If it got to like 98, 99, if you dropped a Dreamcast on him, that janky piece of shit was probably going to break. It's like, we love the Dreamcast, but it's like, even whenever Tom Charnock was on here, we had a great laugh, because it's the jankiest made. I mean, Dave, you were talking about how it's all tightly compact in there. It's the most temperamental bitch of a system ever. It's like, one day you'll load it up and it'll go, nah, I'm not working today. Then you'll give it 3 months and come back and it'll go, yeah, I think I'll let you play that game today. It's like,
are you talking about playing burned games or just like,
no, just normal? Like normal. Whenever Tom was on, that's what he was saying. It's like, he takes out Sega Rally 2 and puts it on and it goes, bring, please insert game disc. He's like, fucking in there. It's like,
yeah.
And then
I've definitely experienced that with burn games. I've never experienced that with legitimate games, but I guess I've gotten lucky. That's the thing. Listen, is you could get lucky with a certain hardware revision, you know, and you not all of them are created equal, right? Like, it's like some could have been made on a Wednesday or whatever, so to speak. They should just
be
better.
Port dies, you plug
person's
in the controller.
Pissed off, but been out the night before on the lash or something. It's like, I've got to build these fucking consoles and mess up.
So Dan. I'm interested in. Oh, go ahead.
I just want to say the thing with the Dreamcast hardware is that, so even the Naomis are infamous for being absolute garbage. Like,
oh, yeah.
Literally, the Naomis are a roll of a dice. If you get one, you're pretty much rolling the craps to see if that thing works, and then it continues to work. Because when that thing dies, like a lot of these, the way that dies, the console is mounted, the heatsink wasn't mounted properly. I don't know the details of it, but essentially in shipping, that thing can just slide off and rip the processor off the board pretty easy. So a lot of those Naomis just die for no reason whatsoever.
But to be fair,
Dreamcasts are no different.
You had the PlayStations that you had to put on the side just to get them to read
the
disc upside down.
Yeah, that's inspiration for PS2.
Of course,
you know,
you had the toilet seat Jaguar CD that doesn't work at all. Like, you could literally buy 10 of those things on eBay, and I guarantee you that 9 of them won't work.
Did you ever go to a friend's house and like the PlayStation was running upside down? I had a friend Gary at school, and I remember I went to his house, and the only way he could play Soul Blade without it skipping was to literally load it, and then he had to kind of turn it upside down.
It's crazy. I knew a kid that did it sideways. Thing. He had it like almost like a PS2, you know?
Yeah.
And he had it in some kind of like jerry-rigged holder to do that. But no, I've never, it's funny because mine works fine. I've had really good, now I have to knock on wood because I really don't want my consoles to like say, well,
I know, let's just,
tomorrow's your lucky day.
Jinx ourselves. I know, it's like,
I know, right? Everybody says the 3DO is going to die on me too. I have a front-loading 3DO, the one with the door that comes out.
Yeah.
Beautiful console. And everybody said, oh, that door is so temperamental, but mine is still, every time I turn it on, I just kind of cross my fingers and pray. And I'm like, and then it does it. I'm just like, oh, bless you. Bless you. Oh.
The thing, it's nothing for nothing, but those PS1s, though, at least you can get parts and like replacement lasers for it. The Dreamcast, you can't get lasers for it. You need to find a new drive because
I have a serious question for Dan.
Literally, the only Dreamcast that I've really found, every time I look up tutorials, like the first tutorial I looked up for Fighting Dreamcast, it literally was, oh, I put the laser in and it didn't work. Cool. Thank you very much. I'm glad. Yeah. So the answer to fixing a Dreamcast is ODE.
Yeah.
So true. Dave, you've got a burning question.
Oh, well, I just want to, I want to continue with the document. I want to know what other, like, what other massive revelations did you, or connections did you make, takeaways?
Yeah. So, I was going to put it back to you. So, but yeah, the 60 market losing momentum. I've got a couple of others, but I'll let you guys go into it. But one of the biggest ones I had on there was one game for the Elder Scrolls Arena coming to the Sega
Saturn. Yeah.
You know, and straight away, you guys are probably the same, but in my head, I'm thinking, how could they do this? And I'm thinking, well, if you, most of that game was kind of flat, you know, VDP2 could be doing stuff there, all the characters are sprites. And I'm thinking, oh man, that could have been a game changer on, if that came to the Sun. So
that was a 94 PC game as well.
It was,
exactly.
Threw the PC crowd right in with that, you know?
Right.
It's funny though, because that was a lot of people for years thought that was supposed to be Daggerfall. And it just came out like with this document, it confirmed that it actually was Arena that was coming to the Saturn. And it just amazes me that they couldn't even get that off of there. And, you know, but, you know, maybe to be honest, though, maybe it's the best that we didn't get a Todd Howard game on the Saturn. We might have got like 12 versions of Skyrim if we did that. But, you know.
I mean, what amazes me is that the Saturn had all of these PC ports, you know, it had Theme Park. It had Myst.
Discworld.
Launch, like Myst was close to launch, or it was a Japanese launch title, and it was very close to launch. And it had mouse support, but we didn't get a mouse, at least until like 97, late 96 or whatever, with the Netlink, right? And it's like, by that time, literally nobody's buying the hardware anymore. And it's like, why couldn't you have given us a mouse? It's the simplest thing, you know, the game supports it. So now it's funny, like now you can, with Blue Retro, if you have like a Bluetooth mouse and you get one of the Blue Retro receivers, you can actually play Myst with the mouse, or you can play Knots with the mouse. Yeah, go this little funny fun fact, this little humble bazooka, very well-built receiver. Plug that in and get yourself a Bluetooth mouse and keyboard. You can play those games with mouse and keyboard support.
I'm definitely going to do that. I'm definitely going
to
do that.
Brilliant.
And you don't have to use the ball mouse. Use the regular laser optic mouse.
And it's super easy. Like this, there's no like spending 15 minutes trying to get it paired. This thing, it a second you plug it in, it's in discovery mode, and it's like, give me a controller. So it just literally pairs for you. It's like, it's amazing. Yeah. So I love it. It's just crazy.
By 12.
You know, it's funny. One of these emails. So there's, we could jump around, but one of these emails really hit me.
I was going to ask, what's your biggest revelation from that day?
Well, there's so many, but this is just happened to be the email that I'm staring at right now. So it's March 21st. It's about Nintendo. Well, the subject is Nintendo. I've been saying the same thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. The original email is from Shinobu Toyota. It's talking about Nintendo told third parties lately that their doors decreased to 10,000 from 20,000 at peak, and expresses concern some retailers are getting out of the video game business due to low margin. This email was March 21st, 1996. Now, here's the interesting thing. Tom says, if the video game industry does not find a way of increasing their retailer margins, we will soon be left with only specialty store distribution. In the past years, we've seen many retailers exit the business. Macy's, Shopko, Hills, Kohl's. Well, more this year if the margin is not increased. Guess what? This is the exact same year that the article I was telling you about in Ars Technica, the dude that worked at Babbage's, his store were closed. And several other Babbage's stores were closing and getting bought out and turned into GameStops. And it was happening back then. It's a change that's been happening since all the way back here. Mm-hmm. That the and it's when it happens gradually, we don't notice it. But basically, the gaming industry has turned into, you know, little plastic cards that you buy at Target to redeem your license to play, basically. And I mean, stores were closing back then. The margins just weren't big enough. They couldn't continue to publish these physical games and sell them for the very paper thin profits that they were making. So it was just
what
like,
was if I remember as well, Dave, seen in there, it was that the retail margin was 6%.
Yeah.
For Saturn.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. 6%. And what was it? PlayStation was like 13.
Yeah.
I can't remember. And of course,
again, is that why retailers again were then pushing PlayStation? They were getting greater returns for the sales. You know, it's
well, yeah, we talked about it on the previous cast that we did. It was just like, I can't imagine being like, if you were a kid, a teenager or whatever, working a minimum wage job at a game store and you're clerking, you're working either on commission or just on the honor of, you know, the internet doesn't really exist in its full capacity. And I'm, it's my responsibility to, you know, to tell people, to tell gamers, you know, what is available and what's the best deal. Well, I mean, the Saturns have been sitting in the back and they haven't been selling, you know, but the PlayStation is just like flying off the shelves. We can't keep it. As soon as it would get in, it would all be gone, you know? So, I mean, a lot of shop clerks probably would think just to, well, get the PlayStation or, you know, get the Ultra 64 or whatever as soon as that comes out. And of course, that was a whole other story. I mean, when Mario 64 came out, they had three games on the platform. One was a remake of Pilot Wings, right? You know, one was a jet ski game. That's what everybody called it. Where's my jet ski game? That didn't make launch because it was delayed. So you had Mario 64, the greatest game of all time, to carry the I'm saying that jokingly. I love Mario 64, but I mean, it literally carried that console like on its shoulders. And I mean, it really was phenomenal.
I was going to say it really goes to show the power of Super Mario 64. And I imagine a lot of people, we joke about the N64 and everyone's going to make joke about it. But I mean, there's a reason why it was so successful in a lot of people's eyes. It just was, there's so many of the good games. Like, I didn't get a lot of games. It didn't get a lot of variety of genres, but the games it did get were pretty amazing, at least first party wise.
But Virtua Fighter was Mario 64 in Japan. You know, Virtua Fighter had that kind of power to sell one-to-one with consoles, almost nearly one-to-one with every console. And didn't matter the Wan Chai connection and Tama and Myst. I like Myst, but like that the other ones in the lineup were not that great. It didn't matter.
Honestly, to I prefer
the Japanese
Myst,
public.
To be honest.
You had Virtua Fighter, which was arguably this like very close to the arcade port of what folks thought couldn't be done. You know, couldn't possibly be done. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have been done on 3DO. I mean, and I'm a 3DO fan, but I don't think the 3DO could really push polygons in the same way. You know, so it was incredible. Again, Virtua Fighter was not, even though you love it. James had an amazing experience with it. Most Westerners just didn't really click with it, you know.
No.
To be fair though, after all the fighting games and used to, you know, 2D fighters, and still to this day a lot of people just don't get Virtua Fighter and they don't really enjoy the mechanics of it, even though it's probably one of my favorite games because it's easy to play, difficult to master, but like a lot of people,
pisses me off that Tekken has evolved onto its eighth game. And like gets all this adoration, and it was just basically like a cheap response to VF.
Tekken has always been a just copy. It's like Maximilian Dude says. Tekken's entire history of Virtua Fighter does this. Virtua Fighter exists. Let's make Tekken. Virtua Fighter 2 does this. Tekken will do that. It's like Virtua Fighter 3 did the undulating stages and all that sort of stuff. Or Tekken 4 does the undulating, and it all just copied.
Listen, nothing for nothing, but we did get a new Virtua Fighter recently. There was a port of a PS3 game.
A remaster.
Another interesting note is that in this document, it talks about knights being viewed as a very, you know, it talks about knights being viewed as a game for younger audiences,
game
right?
For kids,
game for kids. And it says, we need to try to convince them to, you know, add some things or adjust the game to make it, you know, more, have more cachet with like older teens or whatever. But at the same time, you know, Sony reveals this new game called Crash Bandicoot, right? And yeah. Shinobu Toyota says, now that this is Sony's fall September release feature title, let's find out their marketing plans, TV, creative direction, media budget, promotion, etc., and reflect back on our night's plans. And again, I think that they realize that it's like, what's the closest thing we have to a mascot game?
Yeah.
Nights. Mm-hmm. And what would be, oh, wait, Sonic Extreme is nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
We are going to spend massive amounts of money on this huge display. And if you look at the original floor plan, Sonic Extreme was supposed to have wings. Like, it was supposed to be the tower, and it was supposed to have large, several displays, several playable. It's much larger than it ended up being. And then they moved Knights out in front with it side by side and kind of gave Knights more prominence, because we actually have Knights.
Yeah.
Don't have this other game. All we have is like a Metal Sonic boss demo, right?
I mean, we have Bug.
So Bug. They kind of, it was at, it was kind of at that time that they rethought they're thinking, and they're like, well, we have to have something to compete with Crash Bandicoot. So they tried to like boost up Knights and kind of put it out there more, you know, kids game be damned, you know, it's like, this is going to, you know, be the flagship title. And then they started at that moment, they started sweeping Sonic Extreme under the carpet.
Yeah.
I think it's like, but that's something that large, an elephant in the room, you can't just put it in the closet, you know? So it's like, they had to just start kind of tearing it down, you know, brick by brick, and kind of just making it smaller and smaller and just pretending like it didn't exist. You know?
Well, I mean, luckily
Sonic
for Sega,
3D is Sonic 3D is so, it's all through that document. And I know,
oh yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
We know historically, obviously, that the loss of Sonic and Saturn was massive, but mm-hmm. I don't think we quite appreciated quite how devastating it was, because as you say, that it's like, it's Sonic 3D, Sonic 3D, every mention, it's there all the way through. And right. then as you say, it's like, this isn't going to happen. We'll just try and sweep it, and then Knights comes to the fore. But it's like, it was even more devastating than I think any of us ever would give it credit for.
Yeah, because I think through the document, you've got references to Sonic 3D, and Sonic 3D is obviously there's the Genesis version, the Mega Drive version, which is obviously the Frickies Island version. But I think there's certain stages in the document where it says Sonic 3D, but then it says STI.
Yeah.
So that's obviously Sonic Extreme, right?
Yeah,
right. Yeah. Well, that's what I assume. Someone else on Twitter, Neil, I forget what his name was, but is claiming there was another game. I don't have any. Yeah, and Panda was talking about it in his analysis and read through. But again, that's just, I don't want to say it's hearsay. It's just, we don't have any information about that. And because it does say Sonic 3D and then STI, I think that we can all make the assumption, we can all make a correlation there that it's that they're just using Sonic Extreme, 3D as shorthand for Sonic Extreme.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just want to say, going back to the Crash Bandicoot game. Comment. I just want to say that we did end up getting one of the best, the only good Crash Bandicoot game ever released on the Dreamcast, Super Magnetic Neo, which I think is fantastic. Unfortunately, it was the only good Crash Bandicoot game ever released. So, I mean,
yeah, I'm not a big Crash Bandicoot fan. I think the game and the series is massively overrated. But there we go. But
finally, good opinion.
It didn't matter.
My wife loves Crash Bandicoot.
Oh, my wife loves it. She
gives me frights, right? See that ooga booga that it does, right? Like, she, this is us going off on a massive tangent, right? Talking shite like Dave said at the start of the show, right? But like, basically, my wife will hide behind doors and in cupboards and jump out and go ooga booga and give me, I'm like 45 years old with high blood pressure, and she still jumps out and gives me frights, fucking Crash Bandicoot noises.
Oh my god, like, and I'm a broken record at this point, but I mean, Crash Bandicoot, their ad campaigns were brilliant. And again, I think that was Steve Race, you know, it's like, we really, you know, like when you pay a club player to stay, you know, you give them whatever they ask for. Like, we should have paid whatever it costs to keep Steve Race and not have him go defect to the enemy and take all of our trade secrets with him. And then also take his like marketing strategy, because like the way that man could market a system. I mean, sure, Tom was the CEO, and sure, he kind of laid out the strategies, but when it came to like selling the console, you know, Steve Race was
But he was amazing. A man for that. Yeah,
he really was. $299. I mean, hey, Mustache Man. You know, like all of that crap was his. Those were like his ideas, you know, and that was his kind of like his style, his panache. You could tell. And it was like they had it with Sony, and we lost it, and we were making jabs at them, like, Fly, you're not ready. You know, it's like, yeah. Okay, you know, it's like it just. Considering the Saturn's position and that every gamer knew what kind of position they were in, it just didn't play well that they were acting like they're tough shit, you know, and that the PlayStation isn't, you know what I mean? Like, if it would have just been more honest advertising that kind of focused on how good the game is, mm-hmm. instead of trying to cut away to pointless footage of ridiculous things, you know, that didn't matter, like a baby crying in the crib or whatever, you know, it's just like, just show how good the game is, you know?
And I think they did a good job with that on Dreamcast. I think they got their footing pretty well, but at that point, it was a tad too late at that point. I mean, just other external factors, but I think that's why I really appreciate is that the Dreamcast was, it got back, but it, like if they just had one thing, like if they're able to keep pushing it out, I think they could have pushed out the Dreamcast and pushed through that generation.
But you know what they did? You know what they did have in let's see, this email is dated March 28th, 1996. Mm-hmm. Sorry, yeah, March 28th, 1996. You know what they had in Japan that we didn't have? Segata Sanshiro. So you know, Tom is talking about. I just visited 10 retail stores in Tokyo. We're killing Sony. Saturn hardware is sold out. Our interactive displays are better. Stocking is far superior. Can't believe what's happening in Japan. We will win here in the U.S. eventually. I want everybody to understand what's happening in Japan, like you said.
Yeah.
But we will win here eventually. But no, it's like you're not using the same recipe, though. Like, yeah, they've got this brilliant advertising campaign. They've got a lot more software coming out, mm-hmm. you know, and they've just got – they don't have as much – they haven't committed as many sins over there that are unforgivable, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, even negative... in the United States, they had the – with PlayStation, they had like the Crash Bandicoot thing, which was amazing. You know, the guy with the megaphone outside of Nintendo and stuff, like shouting at it, and like, and it's the same sort of in that same vein. I mean, it's not the exact same thing, but the same, you know, vein of like going and like doing this life thing, like just like surrealism in that way, like the, oh, like this is better, like that sort of funny campaign thing. I mean, hell, like they had the guy come back, like, was it a couple months ago at the Game Awards orchestra, like there in the same suit. It just goes to show the marketing power that had.
And like, it's something Takanobu Mitsuyoshi on stage singing the Segata Sanshiro song. Everybody's going crazy. It's like,
yeah.
And he's endured, obviously, he's the inspiration behind the name of this, you know, obviously the Shiro Pod. But it's like, you're right, they just weren't correlating. It's like Tom was acknowledging the success in Japan, but it's as if they were trying to kind of relive the Genesis kind of pomp, that kind of more kind of, we are the market leader, we can be arrogant, we can take pot shots, but it just wasn't working because
it's not the same landscape.
Everything has totally changed since then. So people could see through the bullshit, basically.
And it's just, the surrealism just didn't work. Like, they went with this whole avant-garde like advertising campaign, and it was absolute garbage. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, I admit that Knights is kind of avant-garde, right?
Yeah, it is.
How do you sell that game? I mean, I'll be honest with you, the attract mode sold me. You know, just seeing how bizarre it was, just seeing the fluid motion. It's like they really need to just focus on showing the game in motion, because that's when you get it. That's when you're just like, wow. I mean, I guess to some folks, it's like jumping into a bath of ice water. But I mean, to me, I just liked in motion. It was amazing. But yeah, like, I don't know. I'm not a marketing strategist or whatever. I don't know how you would necessarily sell that game, but I know how you don't. And that's like by doing all that stupid mudslinging stuff when you're in third place. You know, you don't throw, you know, you don't throw stones in glass houses, right? And like when you're the one with, you know, shit on your face because of years of ill will, you know, garnering all this ill will from all these failed consoles that you have to support at once, you know, you're literally just trying to put your fingers in the dam and try to keep it from leaking, you know.
I do wonder if the Segata Sanshiro, kind of marketing approach might have worked over in the West. You know, we've got, as you say, we've got all these avant-garde, really.
If it was Chuck Norris, it was, if we had just swapped out Chuck Norris and gone with that kind of, like, you know,
Saturn, or I'll kick your ass.
Self-aware, yeah, self-aware kind of, you know, like making fun of, you know, because that's the thing, is he'd kick the, instead of using the baseball bat, he'd kick it, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, it's ridiculous, it's asinine, but at the same time, it's funny, you know. And I think, yeah, like beating up the kids on the schoolyard, you know, that's, or as they're walking home from school, yeah.
You know, people can understand it. It's straightforward, so it's just like, yeah, you know, this guy
isn't.
This guy, you know, is Sega Saturn. He'll kick your ass or do all these superhuman things. Where all the fear of the eye stuff and all that other approach just didn't work.
He was like, the Saturn itself had a mascot, you know, and that's important. You know, like that helps. Like it kind of helps give the system character, and then people are like, I want to kind of get behind that, you know. Or let's all, you know, boost it up, and you know, I'm searching for words that I can't find, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah,
you
know? I know what you mean.
Basically,
all
right. Listen,
here's an email. Oh, go ahead, Pat.
I just want to say just the one thing on the advertisement. If I was back in the day and I had the U.S. advertisement, I would just go all sci-fi and I'd do something like a Star Trek parody where it's like, you know, these people are like getting attacked by the Borg, that's PlayStation, and you have like the Voyager, the Saturn that comes in, swoops and kills all the PlayStations and gives people Saturns and like gives the civilization the Saturns and awaken them to the gameplay. Or just do like Stargate SG-1 and just give them a bunch of like P90s or Saturns or something like that and tell them to overthrow the PlayStation gods.
I mean, the one thing as a game, and when we spoke a wee bit about Virtua Fighter earlier on, and you know, it was Virtua Fighter 2 Remix launched in September 96. That jumped out at me because people had came in the kind of replies on Twitter when I mentioned that and said, well, maybe it's VF Kids. And I'm like, well, VF Kids was in October, so I doubt it would have been that. They're talking about VF Remix, but that was 97. So they're very specific in saying launch Virtua Fighter Remix 2 or VF-2 Remix.
Yeah, I think that's Mega Mix.
Do you think that's what it is?
I think that's the bones. I think that's like the skeleton of what would be. That's just my theory personally, because it, of course, it has a Virtua Fighter mode in it and Fighting Vipers, right? Mm-hmm. And you also get some of the Virtua Fighter 3 moves thrown in there. So like, I think that. So they had this, they had the Virtua Fighter Remix, right? Then they talk about Daytona Remix, which I think was just CCE, right?
Yeah.
Because they even say right after the show in May, like live from the floor, Sam Hickman went to E3 96 and then she was talking about it in the mag about how Daytona, I don't think they call it CCE. They just call it like Daytona, new remix of Daytona coming or something, but it has the CCE car on it. So I think that's what that is. And then obviously Megamix, Remix, I don't know. Like, that's what I think is the most obvious thing. But you think there's a whole other game besides like Virtua Fighter 3?
I just think that, I mean, I can't think what it would have done to VF2 to make it any better than it was. That's the thing that makes me wonder if it even was real. But like Megamix, like Fighting Vipers didn't come out until what? Was it October 96 in the States? So that's obviously after the date mentioned for VF2 Remix. They said September 96 launch. So right. I'm like, so like even Fighting Vipers didn't even exist in terms of
didn't
a
even
port.
Exist in, yeah, exactly.
So I'm like, so but I mean, was the idea of Megamix being, but then they mentioned launch September 96, and I'm like,
well,
what is this?
Okay, so something Sega did a lot, something Sega of America did a lot in this document was make assumptions. They would just put in Vector Man 3.
Yeah.
Vector Man 3 on Genesis, Vector Man 3. What did they? They also put in something like Sega Rally 2 on Saturn. Like, it's just an assumption. You know, it's a foregone conclusion that Japan will make this game and they'll give it to us, right? You know, I mean, exactly. Like, so they did that in a lot. They did it enough in this article to make me, or in this document, that made me think that maybe that was just an assumption that they were making.
Right.
Because we had remixes of everything else. This is a thing. We'll do this, right? We'll remix all of our games because they're not ready when they first come out.
Can imagine you, Suzuki, hearing about that and going,
Come again? What do you want us to do?
Have you seen Virtua Fighter 2? I can't do any better than this.
Oh my God. I can't imagine like what it was like to be Sega of Japan and getting some of these requests from Sega of America. And they're just like, these crazy Americans, you know, like, what do they want us to do? And exactly. Oh, they would make promises about, oh, we're going to use Yuji Naka's engine for this or that. You know, he'd be like, you care to ask permission? You know, like, you care to tell me about it and at least get me to sign off on it. That's the thing is, it's like, and again, because in Japan, when you meet someone or you want to work with someone, there's channels, there's like ways that you go about it, you know, because everything needs to be done properly according to their etiquette, you know? And it's like, if you try to fly over that, it'll be seen as rude or just, you know, and it's like, you know, if you always ask for forgiveness instead of permission, you know, it's like nobody's really going to want to grant you permission. Yeah. You know what I mean?
All right.
Check out this email though. This is crazy. So there's drama here. There's actually like, he gets snappy. This is great. Tom says, shouldn't we have made a bigger deal about Nomad for this Father's Day?
Yeah.
End of school, start of summer period. It seems to me that both Game Boy and Game Gear got a huge boost from their first year around this period. Did we do anything to facilitate this? Extra co-op, layouts, etc.? Is it too late? And then
I'm sure dads will love being able to play their Nomad for 1 hour and then it die. Have to put 12
fucking
batteries
in the thing. But Len
Cicerello
like snaps back at him like, this is, I read the drama here. He says, we evaluated the limited marketing budget for this year and we decided that it was not the place to put the money. We have almost no Genesis media this year, and I wouldn't want to spend the little bit that we have on this product during this time period. Tom, you're going to hear this a lot this year, so you need to realize when we cut every corner, there isn't much left.
God damn.
Yeah. Seriously. And wow. I'm just like, and then Tom is like, I wasn't speaking of TV media, rather ad slicks, sales emphasis, reminder of the importance of Father's Day, graduation, end of school, blah, 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 blah. You know, we need to find another way other than just TV to move goods. And of course, it was around that time that they went into all these partnerships with Oscar Mayer, you know, Lunchables and Cookie Crisp, you know, and all these cereal boxes and stuff. I mean, It was kind of a crazy time. You'd be calling up General Mills or you'd be calling up some cereal company and be like, can we put an ad on the front of your box for a Sonic watch giveaway?
Because the McDonald's,
they didn't have the internet. They didn't have social media. It's just, we're so spoiled these days.
Oh, I know.
I just the things that shocks me is that Tom, even in 97, is trying to push the goddamn Nomad. It's like, Tom, like, I'm with that guy. I'm like, Tom, let the Genesis die, please, for the love of God. We have a console that's dying. It's been out for 2 years now, or 1 or 2 years now. It's
question to all of three of you. Should they have made the Nomad in the first place?
No.
Nope.
No. Do we think it's cool? I mean, I think it's cool, okay? But should they have made it?
I don't even know how many years later. In fact,
it never came to Europe.
I seen one in the window of Game Station traded in, and I mean, Game Station's been gone for a long time. It was Game Station in Union Street, and it was in the window, and it was like, I think even then it was like £250 they were asking for it, and this is a long time ago, but I've never used one, I've never held one. It's the Mega Drive version of the Game Gear. Basically, and I'm like, why did you need to make that? Why?
They made something else similar that was also really cool, but it had more collateral because it had a CD in it, and it was called the CDX. Now, as a kid, I looked at both of those ads and I said, okay, I want a CDX, but I was like, the CDX was, the Multimega was cool, but
the Multimega is the CDX, that's the name of it.
Like a portable CD player.
But you guys also had like the Wonder Mega, right? No,
I don't think we got that over here.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So I thought you guys did. We had the JVC Xi, which was kind of like an all-in-one version of the Sega CD, you know. But okay, so over there it was the Multimega, yeah. So the Multimega, I think, is kind of cool. I think the kids thought it was cool. I thought it was cool. It was expensive, but at least it's like if you're gonna build one of these things, if you have to choose one, I would have gone with that one because at least it has the CD in it and can play more games. Like, you know, so it's like you're putting out all the software. This system can support it rather than, okay, here's a system that can support some of your Genesis software, but not all of it, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
See, I'm going to defend the
Nomad?
The Nomad here. I think you coming into this time, 96, I think the Game Boy had just been kind of relaunched with the pocket versions. You know, the color was still a couple of years away. The Game Gear has been on the shelf for 5 years now. I think you think of a generational cycle, you know, the Game Gear is probably coming to the end of its natural life, and I think it will tail off from there. Mm-hmm. In a universe where Sega only promotes the Saturn and the Nomad with no 32X that doesn't exist and stops, you know, trying to push the Genesis on its own, I think it would probably have its place. But as it was amongst the clutter of all these other systems, you know, 1996, you know, we still had, you know, they talked in the era about, you know, Game Gear, 32X, Genesis, Saturn, Nomad. I think Sega CD mentioned in Europe, they were still releasing Sega Master System games, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
They're still doing it in Brazil.
But they still are in Brazil. I think in a universe where they're only support, they say, right, we focus on these two systems. Our new handheld proposition is the Nomad, which, you know, piggybacks on the back of the Genesis. And then our main console is the Sega Saturn in the home. And if you just have those two, then I think that focus might have meant that the Nomad would have its place. But given how it was just lost amongst all the other clutter, I think that's why it kind of feels completely unnecessary.
I just have to say that I think that Sega, having spent years competing against Nintendo, felt obligated to compete with them on every front, including the handheld front.
Yeah.
PlayStation didn't do it, not until PSP. So if you really think about it, was it absolutely necessary? Could they not have put all their eggs in one basket and really fortified that, you know? Like, again, it was sometimes you have to change. Bands have to do it. They have to change their style. Yeah. You have to keep with the times.
They have
times.
To cut their hair and release mediocre albums.
You have to read the room and be aware of, like, what's going on. I mean, again, Nintendo pretty much had the portable market shored up with the Game Boy, and maybe Sega thought, oh, well, we can do what we did again, you know, and, you know, release the Game Gear. But I mean, the fact is, it just, if they could have seen the writing on the wall, and I imagine they could have through these documents, they would have known to just cut it out. Focus on making one really, really good thing. You don't have the kind of cash that Nintendo does. You don't have the kind of cash that Sony does. So take your cash, put it in one huge, you know, I realize that that's terrible advice when it comes to investing and stuff like that. You want to diversify, but not when it comes to like supporting so many consoles, you know. It's like,
well, I think the biggest thing is that it missed the point of what Nintendo was doing. The point of the Game Boy, like they even said from the beginning, it was to reuse old technology into new technology. And that's what they did. But they tried to make current technology and to a portable technology. And it literally was, you know, a 1 hour battery life, and you got to put 12 batteries in the damn thing again.
Which is Sega's like blessing and curse, because Sega was always ahead of the times to a fault. You know, it's like they always had to be on the cutting, absolute bleeding edge of technology. And they were. You know, they had 3D back with the Master System, you know, they had 3D VR with the Master System they had. Very crude, right? But I mean, you know, they had internet before anybody else did. They had, you know, online play. They had, it's just crazy. And they always did. They were always so ahead of the times, but the audience wasn't, they weren't reading the room because the consumers weren't there yet. They weren't there. And
that is what it feels like, is like they tried to copy and paste the success of the 16-bit. They thought, well, it worked back then. We'll just do the same now. We'll just step forward. So when it was 8-bit and 16-bit, we'll now have a 16-bit portable and a 32-bit main system. But as Dan says, it does get lost amongst the whole mess. You know, it's
And Nintendo did it too with the Virtual Boy, but they could afford to lose big on that.
Exactly.
They have more money, you know? And that's the thing with that, you know, Japanese businesses are so conservative and they really want to hold on to cash reserve, you know, for, yeah. I mean, they had some really ridiculously grim market crashes. You know, they went through such an economic just implosion that they wanted to be safe. You know, they wanted some kind of like safety net. And the way the US was just spending Sega into a hole.
So imagine Japan getting the statement through at the end of the month, like it's like getting your credit card bill off. Oh, Christ.
Isn't that what Nakayama said was in an interview a couple of years ago? It was fairly recently. He was saying Sega America just had too much stock and that's where all the losses came from. And you see this and you think, wow, he was on the money.
Yeah,
it's just, and the thing is that Nintendo, like, they, I mean, we can't forget that they released three unsuccessful consoles in a row. I mean, it was the Virtual Boy, N64, and then the GameCube, and they really bounced back to the Wii. But like you were saying, they were able to hold that stock and have that money that Sega didn't have the fortune to have, you know? They didn't have
the success. But look what they learned. Look what Nintendo learned. They learned that creating artificial scarcity with a console, producing less, it's always better to just produce less and make everybody think that it's the hottest thing since, you know, sliced bread. You couldn't get a Wii for like 3 years into the console's life, you know. It was still so scarce. You'd go into Walmart and you'd be lucky, you'd feel like you were lucky or something if you actually got a Wii, which that shouldn't be what it is. But that's kind of the new axiom is now, it's like, just create this artificial scarcity, just like Disney closes films up into the vault and doesn't release them for like a decade. And then everybody feels like they're blessed to get these films that are like super old. That's what Nintendo
figured out. It's
just in time
production,
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And is that but something like COVID happens and then it's like worse because it's like you don't have that backup. So it's like, oh, the factory's done. Oh, we're screwed.
Yeah.
No consoles for like 3 years. Have fun, kids.
And of course, this was all just a game to Sony. They're just like, screw all you guys. We got money for days. Come at it. Let's see who lasts. We'll spend.
We got Michael Jackson. Come at us.
We'll we will spend you into the ground.
See, that's one of the things as well that was in that document, and I thought it was quite relevant to today as well. Is that, you know, they highlight that Sony are leveraging their, you know. And we've spoken about it on the kind of previous shows.
This just
shows.
Confirms that, right?
Yeah. That just made me think back to whenever we came on Editor's Corner and spoke about
it. It's almost
it as well.
What you said word for word, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, thank you. Some kind of, you know, validation of that
exactly
point. You know?
Yeah.
But you're right.
You know, and again, we're seeing it again today with the kind of complaints, ironically, from Sony that Microsoft are leveraging, you know, their position. And it's like, well, shoes on other foot now, bitch.
Yeah, well, I see you guys
beefing on Twitter all the time. There's like three tweets you guys are beefing on there.
What are you guys doing? Are you guys as fed up as us of every Xbox account going, acquire Sega? I'm like, I keep seeing this. We've done it.
Yeah.
At the time of recording this, obviously, we'll have released the podcast, which is out tomorrow at the time of recording. Mm-hmm. This is... Could Microsoft really acquire Sega? You know, and we go into the kind of pros and cons, and we never think it's going to happen. There's just so much going on that it just...
I don't want them to.
No.
I would much rather Nintendo acquire Sega. I want a game company. Like, I want a real, like, game-focused company to acquire Sega and allow talented people to make games, you know, like fun games. And I feel like Nintendo still has that focus at their core. Like, sure, it might be a slap in the face. I might have to swallow my pride at growing up, you know, I would never think in a million years that Nintendo might own Sega. But if they did at this point, I'd be happy, you know.
It'd be a lot better.
It's a holding company, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, God forbid. I mean, you're talking about like swallow your pride with Nintendo, Dave, but that'd be easier to swallow than like for us. Like, see, if Sony ever got Sega, that'd be like a dagger to the heart, man. That would just be we just shut up shop from there. We're like, that's it, guys. Thanks for watching. It's been a great years.
Sony later. So peace. My brother-in-law works for Sony right up the road. His brother works for Sony. They do the God of War games, they do the MLB the Show It's just a different culture, you know. I worked
imagine
for
Dave brooding at the dinner table for Thanksgiving.
No, I mean, like, he doesn't even, it's funny, he has a PS3, a PS4 and a PS5 and a bunch of completely still wrapped games. He doesn't even care about it. Like, he's just like, yeah, they just keep giving me these games and I worked on them, so I feel like I have to have them, you know. He doesn't care at all. It's funny, the people who actually work on this stuff, it's like, you know, anyway, I'm just, and I'm always like, wow, you got a PS5 like day one. How
so,
lucky.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, but no, it's a different culture, really. It's not a good fit, I don't feel. Like, you know, Microsoft maybe is like, I mean, they all were in bed with each other at one point, you know, and it was like you had the Windows embedded CE with the Dreamcast and there was some partnerships, but at the end of the day, I really feel like Nintendo would be the best choice because it's all about games at the end of the day, you know? And the only thing I don't like, I wouldn't like about Nintendo owning them is that it would really change their openness to, like, fans being involved with stuff, you know? Because Nintendo really is, you know, gonna protect their properties, their IPs fiercely. But they're in the movie business now, so they could continue doing, like, the Sonic movie stuff, you know, and, like, they'd have Illumination behind that and stuff, like, you know, so that it just, a lot of pieces I feel would fit. But again, it could just continue to be Sammy Holdings, and
I think that's what it will be. It's,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, Sega are the golden goose to Sammy. You know, it's once if you take Sega out, like, Sammy have no interest in letting Sega go. You know, so it's like,
right.
And like, people are going, like, and you see these kind of fanboy accounts, and they go, well, if we can't take Sega out of Sammy, we'll just buy Sega Sammy. And Microsoft don't want golf courses, casinos, amusement parks, bars. It's like, it's
just, that's stupid.
And they definitely don't want Persona as well. Keep that crap to yourself. No, but the thing is that you think, I'm joking, of course, you think Persona fans are bad now. Imagine if Nintendo buys them and they're Nintendo Persona fanboys. Oh god, don't even want to deal with that, man.
I'm just conscious that it's coming up to 1 o'clock in the morning over
your
eyes.
Yeah, I am too. I'm like, what else do I want to cover? Sports tittles? That's what it says. Saturn sports titties.
I didn't even notice that.
Seriously, no, there's a lot of double problems with double consonants here. But on my trip to SOJ, it was a topic of grave concern. We certainly discuss it. We'll discuss it next week's global review. Sony has taken the lead from us in a short period of time with a great NFL football game day product, now NBA basketball. So somehow, to sum it up, Sony has overtaken Sega as, like, the leader in sports.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, that's crazy because Sega is, like, I mean, if Sega is synonymous with arcade, you know, but they're also synonymous with, like, great sports games.
That's right.
I do feel like there were some really good sports games on the Saturn, to be honest with you. To be fair, like, I actually really like, and I am a sports game fan in addition to being an RPG fan and a racing game fan. Like,
he's a rare breed for sure.
I am a rare breed. I'm very eclectic in my music taste, and I'm very eclectic in my game taste. And I think that there's a lot of great sports games on the Saturn, but again, they didn't have a good football game, American football game, I should say.
We'd Worldwide Soccer 97, the GOAT.
There were no issues. They had I don't have the page, but it said, like,
yeah, I saw that. Like, issues,
nope, no, none.
It's perfect.
Nope. We know how to make a soccer game. We know how to make a football game. So yeah, release that. And it actually,
honestly, I think the best way they can make a great soccer game is if they just made Liverpool FC just be the most OP. Best way to do it.
No.
No comment.
No, mate. No.
There's haters all around.
Of course, there's the warp email, you know, talking about Warp will put off software development for PlayStation indefinitely. They don't like the Sony's distribution policy. This is the email where we found out about that. From now on, Warp will develop titles for Sega Saturn and M2. which of course wouldn't call them, but they actually yeah. I mean they were working on D2
yeah.
For the M2, so yeah, that's what they're talking about. And then and then they go on to explain who Warp is, like, if you didn't know. Warp is a Japanese software developer, aka the developer of D, which I guess the Sega of America really liked D.
They love the D.
They love the D.
yeah, but
the company has sold more than 1 million Ds.
Damn, that's a lot of Ds.
People love the D.
Yeah. Sales of Enemy Zero are expected to be about the same.
But no. In all seriousness, though, those games are really good, and like Enemy Zero is honestly really great, and it's just a shame that they couldn't really get a lot of that. Like, but it was dead by the time Enemy Zero came out, and like they just released like I think two of them total in the States, so two copies.
I imagine it was expensive to produce as well with the four discs, because the PAL versions are a lovely double case. So, one thing that jumped out at me was Ridgeworld Saga, obviously Mystaria sequel, Ridgeworld Saga 2 getting a translation, and Luna both keyed for 1996, so that's financial year 97. So,
right,
yeah. The fact that we never got a translation of the former
Ringworld Saga.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. It's a phenomenal game, right? People need to try it. Like I keep saying that on the Shiro show, like if folks haven't tried it, give it a shot even in Japanese, but if somebody will translate it, you know, I'll donate to that cause.
Yeah. Because the first one's great.
It is, yeah. It's underrated.
And one of the unreleased games that was interesting though is that the Panda mentioned was Dress Park. That Sega STI
Jurassic Park, yeah. Uh-huh.
And what he mentioned is that he thought that he wasn't sure what they were talking about, but I think it might have been the sequel to the Jurassic Park Sega arcade game, because they were looking into it, but then later realized that they weren't able to port that technology to
the Lost World,
like a shooter.
The shooter, yeah, the shooting game, yeah.
The shooting game. Okay, so you think that that might have been like a potential shooter game arcade conversion port.
Yeah, because they released the other one, but because
STI had no involvement, right? STI had no involvement with Lost World.
No, but they did do the actual arcade game.
Arcade. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
One from the shooter. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Because that was Sega AM3 that worked on that.
I mean, what else do we have time to cover? So Netlink was huge for E3 96. Yeah. It was one of their biggest strategies. I think at that point, so this is after they already realize that the ship is going down. They're trying to figure out, like, how can we reposition Saturn and continue to sell it? Oh, here's an idea. The internet's really big right now, right? So let's position it as, let's try to convince people that we're technically superior. That's why they position Saturn as the technically superior next generation system that provides the best gameplay experience, and of course leverage exclusive Saturn peripherals, including internet connector and new analog controller. Of course, like if you go through the thread of emails on the Netlink starting March 13th, and who is it? It's Hideyuki Kodama is talking. He is over in SOJ, basically talking about the build out and saying, like, basically, here are your choices. You either, you know, you he was the one that basically recommended what we ended up getting, you know, which was option C. You know, basically the Pluto had already been spec'd, you know, and I guess they had made a prototype. And the Netlink cart was based on that technology. It was a 28.8, which they insisted on over here because they really wanted it to be an internet browser. You know, they wanted the keyboard, the mouse, email, internet browsing, and then the game thing as well, you know, but they wanted to make it like a cheap computer, like a $400 or $450 computer. And that's kind of how they marketed it at E3. They didn't have any game demos. They didn't have any dial-up play at E3. They had internet browsers. They had Planet Web showing, you know, that people could browse the internet for $400 before internet appliances were a thing. Yeah. When schools were trying to get the internet, you know, they had like a school bundle, you know. But essentially, they wanted the Pluto but it just would have been prohibitively cost prohibitive to produce. Yeah. And SOJ thought it was a stupid idea. They're like, you're going to sell this for how much? 500? You can't even sell Saturns. You want us to build this monstrosity that, which they didn't think looked good either. They thought the design was just like kind of slapshod because it had to force so many components into this space, you know? And so not to mention that it was a prototype, so they couldn't use it. They couldn't show it at E3. They needed to be able to hook it up to a phone line to demonstrate it. And you cannot, according to UL testing and FCC regulation, you couldn't hook a prototype up to a live phone line in the US. So they weren't able to show it there. So instead, what they did is they had the Netlink cart produced, and they popped that into a, you know, Model 2 Saturn. And then they had to get like the Japanese mouse, keyboard, and the mouse.
Was that the thing you said on Friday's Shiro show? It was like, black SOJ hardware, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, that was for any game that was Japanese being developed in Japan, and they didn't have an American hardware, wouldn't play it, you know?
Right.
So they were just like, get us Japanese hardware with black shells so that it all looks, you know, so that the
it wouldn't surprise me if last second they started spray painting some of those sons of bitches black.
Just say that and find it. Tommy in the back with that.
Exactly. I mean, that would not surprise me in the slightest.
If anybody happens to around the San Francisco area happens to find a Sega Saturn that has like Japanese guts inside it and it's a black Saturn, you have like a rare like E3 thing, yeah. You know,
on eBay, sell for $1,000,
but yeah, essentially
$12,000.
Essentially, it was all of these, it was like the combination of the freight on board price and the fact that they were demanding 28.8 because they needed it to be, you know, fast enough to browse the internet on. And even by that time, there were already 56. There were 32. I don't know if they had 56K modems in 96. I'm not sure about that. I don't think so. Probably like 97 or 98. But the best, they had better than 28.8 though. So that was still kind of like modest for that time. And then he said, I don't think X-Band is as popular as internet service. Like basically was saying, if you had to choose, I think people would want internet service over X-Band. Not thinking like a gamer though, you know. It's like, of course, I don't know, X-Band didn't do that great either. It closed down too.
Yeah,
it was ahead of its time, you know. Like
this comes back to Sega being bleeding edge, doesn't it, being there before the market or the technology.
But again, this was their, to use an American football term, this was their Hail Mary pass, right?
Yep.
I mean, it was 97 was really like the make it or break it year.
Fourth down and 20.
Exactly. Yeah. So they were really putting a lot of emphasis on the Netlink thing, which now we know only ever got 5 titles and just didn't do very well commercially.
And it's surprising that we really didn't get a console with actual internet until 2005 when the PSP dropped. That literally was like the soonest we ever gotten something like that. So it was almost like 10 years after that dropped, we had an actual internet device. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, no, that's a lie. I guess they had Linux on PS2.
Yeah, Dreamcast was online as well.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, this one hurts so bad.
Use the web on Dreamcast. What's that one, Dave?
This one hurts so bad. So in March, so basically beginning of April, this is March 28th. So it's basically in E3 is in a month, right? It's basically in a month and a week, right? And they're like, we need to develop detailed implementation plans for our key 97 strategies. Price competitive to PlayStation, $249, right? Of course, they don't realize that at the beginning of E3, Sony's going to say $199.
Yeah.
It was already painful enough. They were already bleeding enough to try to match them at $249. Then Sony says $199. They spent all night on the phone with SOJ after the first day of E3. They spent hours on the phone in talks, long distance talks, to try to get approval for that. And they went to Kinko's or something like that and made these signs $199. Now $199. And somebody from Sony like walked by and said, "You're pathetic." Like there's an article out there on on IGN or something like that, somebody wrote up and that they were hurt. One of the Sony reps was heard saying, "You guys are pathetic," you know, trying
That's
to like
sad,
match
though.
Us. It's wow. sad. Yeah. But they couldn't not, you know, like with an announcement like that, it just kind of was a gut punch. You
it
know,
it could have been the $2.99 all over again.
Exactly. You know? So they yeah. had to like make sure that they could match, and they did on the floor. And there's footage of it. Sega Saturn now $199, and then of course OSSM follows that exact like breaking news. The Saturn is going to drop to £199 because they had to talk to the UK office yeah. as well and be like. You guys, we need Man. To do this, even though it hurts.
The things that you think about, I think people were mentioning that while they did drop, it was a 190 release. I mean, if you think about it, to get to the level of what Saturn would have, mm-hmm. you would need to spend almost like $300+ to get to that level mm-hmm. because you didn't have internal storage in the PlayStation. You didn't have, you know, the extra controllers and stuff. You didn't have a game with it. So
Peach Pat, Peach.
The list goes on, though. It's like here.
But I know people don't see that, though. They see main console $199. It's like, ooh, they don't see, like, you know, they don't care about that. It's like, oh, I can play this cool game and have that. And same yeah. thing with the PS2. It's like, well, I'm going to wait, get a Dreamcast and get a PS2 and a DVD player. So
mm-hmm. I love a lot of these. They just say, like, make Virtua Fighter 2 huge hit. How do you just do that? How do you just make it a huge hit? I mean, you know, I would all love to just be able to say, you know, Twitch artists, you know, make it a huge hit.
I mean, it was a huge hit, wasn't it? Because it was the highest selling game in all three regions. So at least
and they gave it a silver box too. So I guess that was part of making it a huge hit in the West. Launch Saturn VF2 Remix September. So yeah, there's that. Make key titles Knights Virtual On. Make key titles Knights Virtual On, Fighting Vipers, Sonic 3D, World Series Baseball 97, NFL Football 97 hits.
And then it says RPG and just a zero.
I mean, it must be talking from a marketing perspective, right? Like, make them hits, push them, I guess, really hard. Gain parity to Sony. In-store interactive displays. So this is where they start hacking together those kiosks and getting them out to Circuit City and whatnot. So, I mean, they exist. They're around. You know, you can find them in different cities on OfferUp or what are these Sega Saturn kiosks like Pat picked up. They do exist. They were kind of hammered out in, you know, first or second quarter 96. Gain parity with Sony. That they would never even come close to gaining parity, but build 4,000 by September 97 is what they wanted to do. 4,000 of these things. Regain advertising, PR, communication, coolness lead versus Sony.
Honestly, those kiosks are a beast, though. Those are like 300. They're almost a ton, almost. Like it's honestly like I got rid of it mostly. I would have kept it if it was easy, it was a little bit easier manageable, but like. Those things were Hulk, and there's no room to put it anywhere in any other small stores. So it's like
there's an email there as well about Psygnosis. Whenever they talk about the ports, they say they've chosen Wipeout and Destruction Derby, and I think they say we'll assess other titles. Mm-hmm. And then they mentioned about feature parity and making sure that it's, you know, on par with, if not superior, to the PlayStation version. So they were also acknowledging the kind of impact of the Psygnosis games. And,
oh yeah. You know? I mean, they were acknowledging that a lot of their games sucked. They were like, these games are poor quality, very poor quality. You would see a lot, you know.
It's kind of ironic because you think that a lot of those poor qualities are now like, you know, the ones that people want and like are getting translated now. Because there's so many on the list that was like, you know, Shin Megami Tensei Digital Devil Summoner, no, Lunar, no, you know, Jurassic Park, no, you know, all these others, Terra Fantastica, no. You know, all these games that, you know, people wanted, people, you know, would have played, but it's just like, by the time that they realized, oh, JRPGs are popular in the United States, it was too late. Yeah. It was 97, and it's like, Final Fantasy is killing it, and they got nothing, because nothing's in the works, and the only thing that they have on the pipeline is...
Stoloff comes in and goes, no RPGs on Saturn. Yeah. Like, you just got PlayStation Final Fantasy 7, mate. It's like, what are you doing?
I mean, once Mario 64 came out, the craze, like just the absolute manic craze that surrounded that game, and then the ones to follow, like GoldenEye and Star Fox 64 and stuff like that. PlayStation held on to what they had, you know, like they did an admirable job just keeping up and continuing to put out hits and stuff like that. But it was just like at that point, that's the point where Sega's like holding on, being trailed by the car, and then they let go. You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, you have other stuff here, like so Coolness Lead. It's at this point that they stopped really focusing on the we have eight processors with eight processors. You can do it. They stopped doing that stuff and they started doing the Nintendo 64. It's not worth waiting for, you know, or Sony PlayStation. You're not ready. You know, they started doing that because they thought that's what equals coolness, but of course. Everybody has a different idea of what's cool. Like,
ironically, everyone did the exact opposite. It's like, the Nintendo 64, it was worth waiting for.
It was
PlayStation. It was like we were ready and we were blessed because we got all this support. Like, and I'll admit it. I think PlayStation in the West is probably the best way to play RPGs in that era, straight up.
They say sell through current Genesis game, Genesis and Game Gear. Oh, wait, I can't read. Sell through current Genesis, Game Gear, and Sega CD software inventory. That, like, how sell through, which means sell it to people. That's not happening. I mean, it's not happening. You have warehouses full of this crap, you know? Like, that's ridiculous, you know?
And what games, like, the only, I think towards the end of it, they really didn't release anything.
Columns was, like, the big Game Gear game that everybody was buying.
Yeah, Columns is fun. I have a copy of it. But yeah, it's like the big games, like they just didn't really care. Like, oh yeah, who's gonna play the Snatcher game? Who's gonna play, you know, this Hyrule Flying Squadron game? These weird games. No one cares about them. Must release 12.
They saturated the market with Sonic 2. You know, to the point where nobody was buying it anymore, because everybody either had it or didn't want it. You know, and they were like, we have all these extra Genesis 2s or Mega Drive 2s that like were tailor made for like the Sonic 2 promotion. We need to slap stickers for different games and pack different games in on those to turn it into like a Vector Man version or a, you know, Columns version, you know, to try to get these this stock out, you know, and then like test markets where they would try to sell things for like $50 or something to see if it would work, you know. I think they did that with the 32X. Like, let's just try selling this thing for $49. Nobody wanted it for $49.
I remember it being $25 over in the UK.
Oh yeah, that was like bargain bin. That was just like take it.
I wanted one at that place now, though.
Yeah, I know. I wanted a 32X. You know, I thought that was the affordable way to get into the next gen. But by the time it was £25, I was like, yeah, I'm just gonna wait for it until I can afford a Saturn.
man.
But yeah, no, it's just a sadness because, like, I mean, the Sega CD, you can argue there's some really great titles to play on there. The 32X, it's like Knuckles Chaotix, maybe the Super Tempo.
Knuckles Chaotix isn't great, and I say that as a Sonic fan. I mean, that should have been a Saturn game anyway, shouldn't it? I mean, that was originally in development for the Saturn, and then we got moved over.
It could have been amazing on. I mean, yeah, it would have been great. I mean, if they didn't just even in the document it said focus on 3D titles, 3D titles, and try to make all the Genesis games look 3D, like Vector Man and Sonic 3D Blast. It said that it's like try to make and Virtua Fighter on the Genesis. Try to make any new Genesis games that come out should try to look 32 bit. You know,
that Virtua Fighter game on the Mega Drive is fucking awful.
Check this out, guys. Though I want to know what you think. Get expenses / organization in line with likely sales. Complete any restructuring by April 15th. Do you think that restructuring includes Tom leaving? Yeah.
Oh, like, yeah. That means restructuring is keyword for shit canning everybody that they
Yeah. And I think he was just like, okay, well, and this was from him. So he's sending this email out and he's like, well, I know when I'm leaving.
You know, I mean, because he saw the writing on the wall. It's like, well, I mean, I did the best I could, and there's nothing much left. So
when did he step down? I don't have that information right at my fingertips. Or when did Tommy Scholer come in?
I thought Tom left.
'97.
Tom left mid 96.
So he tendered his resignation on July 15th, 1996.
Okay. And this was sent in basically beginning of April. So yeah, just, you know, a handful of months prior. So it was like the writing was on the wall. And he said that the restructuring needs to happen by April 15th. Okay. So he stayed with it a little bit longer. But again, his hands were tied. SOJ wasn't really letting him, you know, take the wheel on things. They constantly had to ask. So Sega had autonomy with game publishing. They did their own long boxes. They did their own game publishing. But when it came to hardware and a lot of software, it was just like they were completely beholden to SOJ to give it to them.
So catch 22, though, wasn't it? It's like, because we always look and go, well, you know, Tom's hands were tied by SOJ, but then SOJ are looking and going, well, you're spending too much money here.
When I say his hands are tied, it makes him sound like a victim. And I don't mean to do that. but what I do mean to say is, whether you agree with his plan or not, he wasn't executing his plan, because if he was executing his plan, it would have released on September 2nd, you know, like from the very beginning, from the very get go, he was forced to it. The ball got rolling and it was all just downhill from there, and he wasn't calling the shots. So I think that he was just like, well, my time here is up. I did what I needed to do on the Genesis. I recreated the same kind of magic that I did with Barbie and He-Man, Masters of the Universe. That's what they called me in here to do. And by this time, it's just like, I'm a ghost of what I was during the Genesis era. So what's the point, you know, like move on to something else and don't be remembered for this, you know, I think, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
What else do you guys want to talk about? That we kind of worked our way through all of the networks.
We covered a lot. So yeah, I was thinking a few points, but we went for a great deal there.
Go for it. Quite a bit. Do you have anything else? You want to talk about Roach Racer? I have no idea what that is. All we have is like a title screenshot. But yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think I'm good on my end.
I'm good on my end.
Yeah, I guess just sad. No RPGs.
No, yeah. we needed some of those translations to come over. It's just a shame that they didn't. But guys, I mean, it's the best part of 2 hours. I know it's early hours in the morning now where you are. You must be feeling it. So I think we'll bring it to a close there. But please, before you go, just let our listeners and our viewers know where they can find you. They should know where you are already, but just in case anyone needs a reminder.
Well, they use SegaSaturnShiro.com or Play Sega YouTube. Saturn. Yeah, you can find us on YouTube at Play Sega Saturn, Twitter, Play Sega Saturn. literally
soon.
And just Play Sega Saturn, basically.
For folks who don't know, Sega Saturn Shiro literally means Play Sega Saturn. do Sega Saturn. But yeah, that's
do
literally
your Saturns.
That, and it also means white Sega Saturn. Exactly. But yeah, so you can find us there. You can find us on our, you know, join our Discord from any of our YouTube Shiro shows. You can link through to our Discord, join
or on our website.
Love to have you. I think you guys wanted to know my favorite game music, right? Sega game music, right?
Yeah.
Very, very, very quick. We'll finish off with my favorite.
Oh, very Sega. Quick. Are so, we like, okay.
So, obviously, your favorite Sega console, your favorite Sega game, and your favorite piece of Sega music.
Okay. Favorite console, Saturn, no contest of all time. What was the second one? Favorite
Sega game.
Favorite Sega game is Knights. Well, actually, it's my favorite game of all time, Knights into Dreams. And my favorite music is going to be the PSO soundtrack by Hideaki Kobayashi, Fantasy Star Online, Sonic Team game, and Hideaki Kobayashi. Like, that soundtrack is just, I like the Knights soundtrack, but I like that one even better.
Brilliant choice. What about yourself, Pat? Favorite console, favorite game, favorite music?
Favorite Sega console, Dreamcast, Saturn, pretty much almost on par. It's like sort of like this sort of thing, neck and neck. What's favorite Sega game?
That's a hard one.
I know,
that's really hard. I guess technically, on the Saturn, probably Magic Knight Rare Earth, if I had to pick one. I think it's a really fun game, technically developed by Sega. So
there you go,
I'll take that.
It counts, mate. It counts,
yeah, yep. I can totally.
And favorite Sega music. You know, that's a hard one. I think probably Sonic 3's soundtrack, but I mean, if you know me and my music taste, you could probably take a wild guess why Sonic 3 specifically is one of my favorite Sonic soundtracks.
Mm-hmm. Michael Jackson. I mean,
a lot of that, Brad Buxer specifically. Well, Brad Buxer is actually had a local band in where I'm at in Arizona. So mm-hmm. it's like local artists on that album, and just the music on there is fantastic. Cause cool. I mean, well,
yeah,
but yeah, so probably that, or maybe Sonic Adventures soundtrack specifically. I love that mm-hmm. soundtrack so much.
Any particular songs?
Probably the first song on the beach. The drums in that sound are probably the best drums I heard in a video game. I love that one. One of my favorite songs from that one. In terms of the vocal track, it probably is. I really like the Believe in Myself one, Tails one. That one's really.
Oh, I forgot about Can You Feel the Sunshine?
very quickly, there was a. There's a track on Scud Race, right? And it's the Aztec track. And I'm not kidding. Right? Listen to it. Go on YouTube and go to the Scud Race OST and load up the Aztec Amazon. Track. It's literally from Sonic Adventure. It sounds almost nigh identical to a track that's in Sonic Adventure. I was playing it and I'm going like, is this ROM being hacked? Have I got like Sonic Adventure music on here?
They did that a lot. Metropolis Street Racer, there's a da 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 da, and that's doesn't really matter. So there's another song, you know, on one of the other soundtracks. I forget, is it Sonic 3? I think it's Sonic 3D Blast that has the da 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 da.
Yeah,
it's like you know, yeah. So
no, that's Metropolis Street Racing. It doesn't matter what your name,
right? And then they use the same tune in Sonic 3D Blast.
Yeah,
yeah. So there you go, or Flicky's.
Flicky's Island.
Guys, it's been an absolute joy. I think we could have talked for hours, but conscious that it's late. Yeah,
somebody has to edit this. Yeah, you guys edit or just throw it up? Well, good
guys,
luck.
Yeah. Well, guys, that's been an absolute blast. We'll have to do a lot more of these because every time.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for making it work. I know it was hard.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thanks for taking the time and coming on. It's been an absolute blast.
We love you guys. Yep.
No, everybody right, knows yeah, love you guys.
We'll continue to pump you guys up on our end and let people know that they got to sub to you and they got to listen to your podcast. It's amazing. I look forward to all the wonderful creative things that you guys are going to do. I'm sure you've got some bangers just that we just don't know about yet. I mean, if you could do the dream that I want a Saturn Awards show though. That's the one that I'm
always coming.
Yeah.
Good. Oscars, coming, Saturn Oscars.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll be there.
Fantastic. Same. So viewers, listeners, please check out the Shiro guys. Let us know what you thought. If you've seen the document, you know, give us a comment or get into the Discord, if it's Radio Sega or the Shiro Discord. Contact mm-hmm. us on Twitter. You can find us at Sega Guys. You can find James mm-hmm. at the Segaholic. You can find myself at Swooper_D. But until next time, we will see you on the Sega side.
You must play Sega Saturn.
Sega! We'll be right back.